And we are going live in 3, 2, 1, go.
Is this thing on? Hello? Hello? Social media, hello? Welcome to the Technocrat Live. I'm Matt Newhall, your host. This is George Portugal.
Hi, thanks for having me here.
Thank you so much for being on. So, in case you guys don't know, we do a little bit of news, and then we'll get into your background and what you've been doing and why you would be interesting for people and why they want to see you on the show.
Okay.
So I just got a couple of kind of like personal news things, and then we'll get right into the news report, the aptly named news report that was recently named. First of all, thank you for the subscribers. Thank you so much. If you want to help out the show, you could send me money, you could give me likes, but I don't really care about that. What I really care about is subs. Give me subscribes. So I have a new goal to get 50 subscribes across all platforms by December. Please consider subscribing. It means a lot to me. And as far as I know, there's nobody else on the net doing a show like this. This is pretty unique. So, join us. All right. So, there's another thing, too. Oh, yeah, the Technocrat Live playlist. I've added a few songs. Please keep the suggestions coming. I'd love to. I'm a ruthless dictator, so I may just reject your song, but I still welcome the suggestions, and if I can fit them in there, I will.
I feel bad. He rejected half of my song. So
yeah. Yeah. Steve likes some really awesome music that is kind of fringe. So
really weird.
There was some weird. Yeah. Thank you for admitting it. There was some weird stuff in there that I was like, yeah, they're gonna turn around and run. But then, sometimes tech is like that, right?
Absolutely.
Sometimes it's not, you don't really feel like you're doing anything until people are fleeing for their lives. Speaking of fleeing for your lives, now we're going to do a little segment called The Dystopia Report, because we laugh in the face of doom.
Yeah.
All right. So this first one's from Isaac. Thank you, Isaac. Keep them coming. By the way, if you have any questions, feel free to log into Facebook, or if you have our personal contact info, you know who you are. You can text us or whatnot. Yes, we don't hide our phones on here. Yes, we live in the year 2019 on the show, so everyone's staring at their phones all the time. There's no reason to stop now. it's too late. So anyway, this one's from Isaac. So it turns out that some penetration testers were arrested in Iowa for penetrating. great. Just fucking brilliant. Yeah, that's their job. You shouldn't put them in jail when they find a flaw in your security. That's what you paid them to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's not a lot to say on this except dumb.
Yeah.
Really dumb. So this is a serious thing. Make sure if you are doing any kind of security work at all, but especially penetration testing, get a really good disclaimer. Hire a lawyer and then hire a lawyer to threaten to sue your other lawyer.
Yeah, that's crazy.
We've had lots of lawyers on the show. We could probably refer a few, which is really weird. There's a lot of lawyer-tech crossovers in the area. So we've had 3 on the show.
Wow.
In the past like month and a half, so but anyway, I can't believe this happened. I can believe it happened, but I can't believe Iowa. You suck.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Anyway, so that was kind of a little more lighthearted. This is kind of mess of text here on the sheet. It refers to there was recently a report that came out, and this started as a No More Secrets moment. If you're familiar with the movie Sneakers, turns out it's not that at all. It was just worded really poorly. Like maybe somebody who thought they knew what computers were and how they worked wrote a scary story about Russia, and so it's a little strange. It turns out it is a real story. They just completely misrepresented it on the original link I found, and oddly enough. The first link was Yahoo News, and they broke this story, and they were saying that, oh yeah, there's a whole new connection with Russia attacking our intelligence agency's encryption, and blah, 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 Trump, blah, 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 bad, blah, 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 blah. It was really, if I quoted it, it wouldn't even make any sense. But the way I read it, the quote was, the discovery of Russia's newfound capacity to crack certain types of encryption was particularly unnerving, according to former U.S. officials. crack certain types of encryption. That sounds like they cracked Blowfish or something to me.
Yeah.
So it was really irresponsible for Yahoo to write this way. Someone immediately corrected me with another news story, which not only corrected this news story, but cited Yahoo by name in the correction and said Yahoo said it wrong.
Of course they did.
Yeah. So this is the correction read as such. Yahoo News cited former officials former officials who said the Russians had access, likely the actual substance of FBI communications, but the two former officials told NBC News that they did not believe, it was NBC, did not believe that to be true. Former senior officials said they had seen nothing to suggest Russia had successfully decoded U.S. encrypted government communications. They just figured out the protocol for how and when they would send encrypted communications. This is standard spy stuff. I'm not saying Russia isn't guilty. I'm not saying that we should
aware. But it's totally mischaracterized, yeah.
Yeah, this is a pretty severe mischaracterization, and I mean,
unfortunately, this is like a recurring problem with with news articles about tech, with news articles about science, and if you're not a tech expert or science expert, you can easily read something like this and just get, yeah.
Right, and actually, so later I wanted to talk about, but just talk about it now, a Gell-Mann effect.
Mm-hmm.
So I believe that's the right thing. Look at my page. There's so many like little names and weird isms. I believe that was the right thing. Oh God! Didn't I highlight it?
Yes, you did.
I did. What? All right. Anyway, well, so yeah. Oh yeah, here it is. The Gell-Mann amnesia effect. It's on the first page.
Here it is.
Forgetting media and credibility. So the idea with that is. It's just it was just a hypothetical discussion based on a couple of papers that people wrote that actually seems to happen a lot, which is that if you're an expert in a field and you trust a news source and then you read an article from that news source and you say, this is garbage, this is completely wrong, it's mischaracterized, it's misleading, and then you continue to trust that news source for the next article they write.
Yeah.
You're crazy. It's kind of like a specialized case of cognitive dissonance.
Mm-hmm.
So, good. You know exactly what I'm talking about. Do you any opinions on that, or how we could stop this, or?
Yeah, I mean, it's a tricky thing, I think, because. So you know, we didn't go into my background yet, but I'm a scientist. That's my background, and I know that, you know, when you have expertise in science or technology, that you're usually dealing with concepts that are complicated, and to somebody who's a layman, it's hard to take those ideas and communicate them in a simple way while not losing the important thing, without losing the important meaning.
Right,
of
we've
things.
Debated metaphor before here on the Technocrat Live.
Yeah.
So, is it good? Is it bad? Depends. Keep going.
Right. But it's just a routine thing that you come across, and it doesn't matter if you're talking about the New York Times or some small local paper or what have you, where the information is so watered down and so misconstrued. And I don't know. I mean, in terms of this particular kind of cognitive dissonance, I think it's perhaps something to do with the fact that when you're reading a news publication, you're taking in everything, not just
right.
the tech. Or the science, or the thing that you're an expert in.
Yeah, I mean, clearly, it's not fair to ask journalists to be specialized in everything. They can't know everything. But at the same time, you know, at least it seems clear to me there needs to be some kind of retraction path.
Absolutely.
And CBS retracting Yahoo. What are the odds? The only reason I know about both of them is because I got into a discussion with someone. Thanks, Jeff, for talking this over with me. I got into a discussion with someone about it. If I hadn't been talking to someone completely not in the press,
yeah.
who was also like, yeah, that's not what they meant, and that's just how I read it. And yeah.
And I
just, to me, originally this was about, you know, no more secrets, but now it's like about press incredibility.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, so personally, I'd like to see maybe some kind of retraction rules. What do you think about a law or maybe a
some
social
kind of
pressure to get them to?
Some
social pressure now, and it's not working.
Some kind of a procedure should be in place. And I think a greater reliance on experts needs to happen between journalists and the people that they cover, whether they're, you know, again, in tech or science. So, like, you know, like you said, you can't be an expert in everything, but having science and tech writers have at least some kind of background in there is, I think, a prerequisite.
Yeah.
I think that they need to kind of take their biases in check too, because like the press has this bias towards what's new is hot and what we should talk about, and in science or tech that may not necessarily be the case.
If
you know,
it bleeds, it leads, right?
Yeah.
But the problem is, if it isn't, if the story isn't actually bleeding, did they blow it because they didn't understand it, or did they make it look like it was bleeding because it would, that's what would sell?
Yeah, that's what happens all the
time. I mean, the original story had 2,000 comments on Yahoo.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was extremely popular. People were talking about it. It was a lot of buzz around it.
Yeah,
enough buzz that another news agency actually issued a retraction for a different
on their behalf. Yeah. It's crazy. But yeah, to your point of having some kind of, yeah, there needs to be some better accountability, some better protocol in place when mistakes are made, because they're going to happen, and I fully understand that. What these writers are being asked to do is not easy, but they need to do a better job, and when mistakes happen, it needs to be corrected quickly.
So one of the things that I've noticed, I don't know, so you work a little bit in tech, right? So you know, you're familiar with how websites work, and you know,
yeah.
I mean, one of the problems of with the press is that they'll put a story up, and something will be wrong.
Yes.
Either because they didn't have a sane procedure for verifying a complex topic, or because they're up to no good. Let's assume it's idiocy and not malice.
Sure.
You know, but then they don't issue a retraction in the same URL. So they issue it in another URL, which no one goes to because there's no buzz.
Yeah.
Because the other one bled, so it led.
Yeah, and that's related to what we were talking about. People don't notice retractions or read retractions unless the error is so massive that it becomes news in and of itself.
Right.
When like,
ship steers into dock because of GPS coordinates were wrong or something. You know, GPS tuning coordinates were wrong.
Right.
Something like
some
that.
Massive thing. And
yeah.
And then it becomes news because they just blew it so royally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I made that up. But that would be a good example of like the kind of thing that would have to happen for a news story to actually eclipse the previous news story that was
That was misleading. Yeah.
Yeah. It's not fake news. It's just
no. It's not. It's not malicious. Like you said.
Sadly mistaken news.
Yes.
So yeah, I have another thing to add to the fake news world, which is the sadly mistaken news world. All right, so that was good, thanks. So it turns out that China is cloning dogs. So they cloned...
cats.
Well, no, dogs, too.
Oh, look at that.
Yeah. So this company called Sinogene has cloned 40 dogs successfully.
Okay.
And they typically charge $53,000 to clone your dog. They're
chump
using
change.
Chump change, yeah, right? If you love your puppy, man, 53,000.
That's it? Now, come on.
Yeah, fair enough.
Nice. And now they're offering a cat cloning service. That's how I found about this, because the article's about the cat cloning service.
I see.
Yeah, so, $53,000, and you can get Fluffy copied.
Expensive.
Yeah. Well, it might be a really awesome dog, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, how can you really put money on your pet's value?
Yes, $52,000.
Yeah, apparently it's $53,000. Nice.
Exactly.
Well done, sir. So, I don't know. What do you think? Is it ethical to pet cemetery? As Steve so aptly put it,
yeah,
pet cemetery your pets?
You know, I can live with this. I actually think this cost will continue to go down as sequencing gets better, as cloning methods get better.
Yep.
This will become something that anybody could do at some point.
So sequencing is pretty cheap these days.
Yes,
right?
It is.
I mean, I've heard estimates as low as $1.
Yeah, it's gotten
per sequence.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, that's gotten. I don't think that's the bottleneck in terms of the cost right now. I'm less familiar with all the ins and outs of how the cloning process works. I mean, I know it, but not like in terms
right,
of
right.
dollars and cents of like what part is the expensive part. But I can imagine. Yeah, like in the early or I'm sorry, the late 90s when Dolly was the first sheep that was cloned. First thing that was cloned.
Right, pre-CRISPR.
Yeah, that was like piles and piles of money compared to 53K.
CRISPR, so if you're not familiar with CRISPR, CRISPR is a relatively new development, past 6 years, I think.
Give or take, yeah.
A pile of different universities each came up with a different piece of figuring out how a bacteria actually writes pieces of offensive or attacking DNA into its own DNA as its own kind of internal one-cell immune system.
That's right.
And then what they do is it actually kind of does a Lego thing where it says, okay, you're looking for this and you're replacing it with this. It's essentially a search and replace for genes.
Right.
So, and we didn't have anything like that before. You had to shoot a bullet at with a bunch of genes on it at a petri dish, and you had to do that over and over and over again.
Yeah, and you had no control over where it landed, and like you said, eventually it landed in the right place.
Eventually it landed in the right place, or it didn't, and your company went bankrupt.
But, right.
So that's how Monsanto did all those wonderful GMO crops, although maybe there's new ones now that they're being more precise with.
Yeah.
All right, so I'm kind of okay with this, too. I was kind of in a sticky situation a couple episodes ago. I didn't get too far into it. I kind of chickened out. I'm sorry I chickened out. it turned into an animal rights discussion,
mm-hmm.
to which I went, you know, and I'm not... I think hurting animals is bad.
Yeah, sure.
But also, I think hurting people is bad, and it's slightly more bad.
Yeah.
So if there's no other alternative, I'm kind of okay with animal testing. And, you know.
Yeah, you can't model human diseases on a computer. I mean, you can. You can, but not like in the kind of way where you could actually.
We can't have a control.
No. You can't.
Right, science, you need a control, and you can't really ethically have a control without enslaving someone.
Right. So right, as long as the application makes sense and there's no other way, then that's what you have to do.
Right. Anyway, clone cats, people.
They're here.
Yes.
53K.
You can pet cemetery your pet now. All right. So, huge news, and this is actually kind of the biggest thing for today. But then again, it isn't. So, I mean, this is like, you know, one of the things I wanted to talk about, the Dystopia Report is growing. Not only are subscribers growing, but the rate at which our subscribers is growing and the rate at which the Dystopia Report is growing is changing too, and it's increasing. I mean, the amount of tech news that's out there, I had to reject a few things. Like, in the past, everything I found, I left in. I left some stuff out. Because it's crazy. The stuff that happening, it's happening faster and faster and faster. And I feel like in a couple of years, we're just doing this. I could just do this, right. I don't want to do this.
No, I
really
know.
Appreciate
yeah.
it, I guess.
Yeah,
and
of course.
Like, you know, but, like, yeah, I mean, this is... I think you can argue about how it happened, and I have my own economic theories about it, but we're getting hit with like this wave of disruptive technologies that are just completely taking everybody who used to be in charge, who used to have all the money, who used to call the shots, and just throwing them aside.
Yeah.
And the good thing is sci-fi world.
Yeah.
The bad thing is war.
Yeah.
Right, because people don't like to lose all their money.
Of course.
You know, billionaires don't like to be normal.
Yes.
Yeah. So, yeah, there's a little bit of risk here, too. All right, anyway, back to Richard Stallman. So Richard Stallman, if you don't know, I'm going to give you a little bit of background. So Richard Stallman is the person who founded the Free Software Foundation and wrote commissioned, let's say, I don't know if he actually wrote it, he helped write it, the GNU Public License, which is the license that all of Linux and a lot of early open source stuff was published under.
Yeah.
And it's a super important moment. This is what the Linux kernel, this is what Linus used on the Linux kernel when he released it. And he realized that an older license called the BSD license, and this seems really boring, but it gets interesting. It gets really too interesting. A little hot to handle. The BSD license basically says do whatever you want. The GPL says if you distribute this, you also have to provide the source code. The difference is some versions of BSD are used in OS X and you can't get the source anymore.
I see.
And in Linux, that never happened. It's actually legal. People get brought to court. There's all kinds of foundations out there that will take them to court, including the Linux Foundation. The EFF, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and so forth. So his organization is the Free Software Foundation. He's been doing this. He was out there saying source code should be open. At the same time, Bill Gates was out there saying source code should be closed and people should be paid. Literally, he was like kind of like the antithetical
Bill Gates,
the antithesis to Bill Gates. And the pattern matching doesn't stop there. So He's in a lot of trouble. He recently was asked to leave his honorary position at MIT and asked to leave the Free Software Foundation. And apparently this is over a 2000, a lot of things. So I'm just going to just come out and just say it. You know, a lot of people, I've known a lot of people who have worked with him directly and or people who have worked with him indirectly, and a lot of people have said that he can be kind of jerky, that he can be kind of pushy, that he can be a bit of a lecher. In other words, you know, he's hitting on women at every opportunity. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, like there's never, you know, he doesn't just wait for them to go to the bar to unwind after the show's over. He'll do it while he's walking on his way to his talk, or like there's no limits,
uh-huh.
Right? And that's important, that there's no limits. This is something that matters. So apparently, in the clincher that a group of very angry people got him to quit, got him forced out. He didn't quit. Was when he wrote in 2006 where he said he mentioned that Dutch pedophiles had formed a political party, and he said, "I'm skeptical of the claim that voluntary pedophilia harms children. The arguments that it causes harm seem to be based on cases which aren't voluntary, which then are stretched by parents who are horrified by the idea that their little baby is maturing." So he's always been controversial, on the edge of things. This was badly worded.
Yeah.
But it's probably the most offensive thing he's ever said on the topic.
Yeah.
I'm turning a little red just reading it. But this is what he does. He actually broaches important, meaningful, and pertinent topics before they're important and meaningful, and then promptly puts his foot in his mouth and everybody argues about it. And that's been his specialty since the beginning,
okay,
and that's
so
one of the reasons he was where he is, as important as he was. So apparently a lot of women, particularly women at MIT, are angry because he's been hitting on them. I don't know.
Understandably,
how to put it.
Yeah.
Yeah, understandably. I'm not even defending his behavior in the sense that I'm not going to defend his behavior in a conventional way. I actually have a completely different take on this. You may know where I'm going with this already because you read it. Just in to be fair and to be equal, because I mean, if he wanted to come on the show and talk about this, I would let him. RMS said, "The coverage totally mischaracterized my statements. Headlines that I say I defended Epstein. Nothing could be further from the truth. I called him a serial rapist, and he deserved to be imprisoned. But for many people who now believe I defended him, and other inaccurate claims, I feel a real hurt because of what they believe I said."
Hmm.
So this doesn't sound like a person who's plotting against your children, at least not in that paragraph.
Yeah.
It sounds like almost like a different person. So, you know, all right. So these are rhetorical, these are thought crimes, and there's conflicting evidence. And it's not an apology, but
no, it's not.
It's not an apology. But so, in fairness, it's totally, it's completely fine to talk about what the age of consent should be.
Yeah.
Right. You know, which is how I would have worded it if I went there. I mean, there's some people who are saying children should be able to vote. You know, they can drink at 21, they can get killed at 18, and they should vote at 16.
Right.
You know, okay, they should control the nuclear arsenal from the world's greatest superpower at 16. What? You know.
Right.
Yeah. But at the same time, I'm not going to go get that person fired. I'm not going to, like, double down on cancel culture for them because they said that.
No.
So, what's really going on? What is the deal with Richard Stallman? So, here's my take. This guy is on the autistic spectrum. This guy, Richard Stallman, is clearly on the autistic spectrum. This isn't just me saying this. I'm not just being hyperbolic.
It's just like out of nowhere.
Yeah, well but it's true. His behaviors actually act just like autism. And this is something, and there's a lot of people in tech who have some variation or some intensity of autism.
Yeah, Asperger's or some kind of high-functioning. Yeah,
sure, like,
that happens.
Yeah.
I've never.
So this is actually brought the DSM-5, which is the handbook for mental illness, in case it came up. I wasn't sure if it was how deeper we're going to go on this. So the way that it reads, it's for a neurotypical case of someone who's on the autism spectrum, including Asperger's. He's speculated, by the way. Richard Stallman has never been diagnosed with autism, right?
Okay.
But he has speculated before that he has Asperger's.
Oh, so he himself thinks this may be possible.
He has said he thinks, but he never got himself diagnosed.
Okay.
Right? So one of the things that happens with people that have autism is that they are attracted to unusual objects, like visually attracted. They stare. They can't help it. This is actually a symptom of a disease that a person is born with. So if someone comes in with big hair and their boobs are out, like literally their breasts are in a tight shirt and facing forward, it's not weird for someone who hasn't trained themselves to stop doing it to stare if they're on the autism spectrum. I'm not saying everyone on the autism spectrum does this, because first of all, it may not be their particular symptom, and second of all, they may have trained themselves not to do it. But if he's never been diagnosed, nobody ever stopped this guy.
No, and even if he is, just lots of social cues are difficult for people on the spectrum.
I mean, right.
All manner of social cues.
Right, he could be totally horribly offending someone.
And not even know it, or,
possible. This is one of the things that, this has been something that's come up again and again, with my own interests, in my social circles. People with mental illness, sometimes they have something to contribute. I mean, just from a purely selfish point of view, not even talking about whether you actually care about them or not, just from like, let's make society as healthy and useful as possible, you kind of want them to participate sometimes. Psychopaths can be useful. People on the autism spectrum can be useful. People with schizophrenic and on the schizophrenic spectrum can be useful.
Sure.
You just have to accommodate their needs. And the problem is that this is, I'm not saying that people should be forced to diagnose. I'm just saying that the problem with witch hunts is you prevent these people from participating in a useful way.
Right.
There's been lots of public figures that you could easily say, like, what do you think the odds are that Isaac Newton was on the autistic spectrum?
Yeah.
Probably pretty good, right?
Yeah, wouldn't be surprising.
Just based on the stories about him and his behaviors and how he interacted with people.
Yeah.
No one's ever going to diagnose him. Maybe one day there'll be a definitive genetic test that will exhume his body or something crazy like that. But, would we be better off if he was not allowed to be part of society?
Right, no.
Because he picked up women, Yeah, so this is going to be really controversial. I'm not sure who's going to watch this, but my viewers for sure. And I'd love you to have, if you have some feedback on this and whether you think we should just, block out autistic people on the autistic spectrum from being part of the workforce, if we should require that they become officially diagnosed. I think that's a little dangerous.
Sure, if it's required, yeah.
I think canceling cancel culture and replacing it with forgiveness culture probably is better. Because at least in the case, I've known people with autism who had that problem specifically, and when someone repeatedly told them, don't do that, it's offensive, eventually they stop.
Mm-hmm.
It may just be a case of someone didn't say, hey, you have to listen to this advice because you have an illness.
Yeah.
So I don't know how to... I'm not saying I have all the answers. It seems pretty clear to me that there's something bigger going on here. And I'm really scared of the prospect of, kicking out one of the more important groups in the tech world from working in the tech world anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway. all right. Well, that's the Free Software Foundation chaos. In something on a lighter note, someone has invented a bicycle helmet with an airbag. Yes, a bicycle. Apparently, if you crash, the airbag will explode and protect your head from. And they're claiming that it is the most safe bicycle helmet you can get. And here's the kicker: it's a company called Hovding. Here's the kicker: is that it's not a helmet. It's actually like a neck brace.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And you put it around your neck, and it just looks like a fat scarf. And then when it goes off, it goes boom, and goes over your head
over
and creates
your head, like a little bubble.
Yep, and you look like you're wearing a helmet from Spaceballs.
Suffocate or no?
No, it doesn't go over your face, too. Although, I guess if you put it on backwards, you would suffocate.
Yeah.
That would be kind of exciting. Right now, Hovding's lawyers are frantically running around going, oh, my God, put this side in front.
That's right.
Where the brace?
Yeah, you just wear, basically it's just like a fat scarf, you put it around your neck, and you just ride around like that, and then if you, somehow it figures out that you're having a collision, that you're flying through the air, or there's been a sudden impact, a G-force, and it deploys, and you have an airbag around your head.
So, just that, no helmet.
Yep, just crazy. Like that. Yeah. it looks like a space ball helmet when it's deployed. It's
yeah,
crazy.
That's awesome.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, like, wow. Holy cow, you can't make this up. So apparently it's going to be, I'm estimating, based on they did it in British pounds, but apparently it's going to be about $300. So.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, sure. I can't wait for the first person to wear this on a motorcycle.
Absolutely.
And get a ticket for it and bring it to court. It should be
yeah,
good.
Yeah, that's totally coming.
Excited about genetic modification yet? No? Oh, you're going to be. It's going to get real exciting. So it turns out that a group of scientists have decided to put together a genetic package for mosquitoes and breed specific mosquitoes, and they fluoresce the genes so they know which ones they are, mm-hmm. and they put a terminator gene into the genes of these mosquitoes with the idea that they would breed and then they would kill the other mosquitoes. Actually, so in fairness, I've sat in a talk at a lab with some of the scientists working on this project.
Very cool.
Yeah, and they were very conscientious and really worried about the consequences of things going wrong. And really, technically, nothing's gone wrong except the fact that they released these mosquitoes into the wild and it didn't work.
Oh.
So the fluorescing gene is showing up in many, many generations later. So at least some of them survived.
So, yeah.
So the question is now, are they adding to genetic diversity? And one of my favorite obscure, ignored scientific terms, which I have been very careful not to talk about up till now, but things are getting so crazy, I don't think I can hold anything back anymore, which is hybrid vigor. So I'm sure you're familiar with hybrid vigor. And the idea is that if you have two organisms that are genetically diverse enough,
yeah,
that their offspring will actually be stronger than either parent as a result of that
That crossing, yeah, that mating, basically.
Yeah. And so there, some people are actually arguing that the reason that it's succeeding, that you still see the fluoresce gene, is hybrid vigor. But I don't know if I'd buy that either. So because mosquito lifespans are very short.
Very, yeah.
So like it should have phased out pretty quickly. I'm kind of scared that the fluorescing genes are still around. I'm glad they put the fluorescing gene in there. At least we know what the result is.
Sure.
Yeah, but if we keep doing this and it keeps failing, we might actually be making the mosquitoes stronger. That's the argument.
It's entirely possible. Yeah. This isn't even. There's so many cases of genetically modified organisms getting out into the wild in some way or another. And like you said, at least this you can visualize. There's plenty that you can't. You'd have to sequence them to even know.
Right. So, yeah. I mean, ethically, great work putting the fluorescing gene in there. I think that should be the standard for any kind of genetic modification that makes its way into the wild. Although there's interesting implications for designer baby packages for really rich people if they're fluorescing their genes too. Then again, you really don't need to fluoresce them because, of course, I actually think there's going to be a blue blood package and there's going to be social
God, that's
consequences
coming. Yes.
For it's probably going to be in the next 5 years.
Oh my God.
They're going to be born in the next 5 years, I think. So we're really this is now, people. All right. So anyway, I'm not against using genetic solutions for disease. I mean, of course, that's great.
Yeah,
but
sure.
At the same time, it's not going to be equally available.
Yeah, no.
And and also the people sometimes think they know. I talk about schizophrenia or Asperger's.
Oh yeah.
Or or psychopathy, or there are other neurotypical and non-neurotypical diseases that people think are terrible, which actually have a genetic reason that they're there, and sometimes we don't know it right away. They didn't know sickle cell anemia was malaria immunity right away.
Sure.
They didn't know that there was a gene in Europe that was immune. There was a deficiency. There was a defect in the immune system that actually made the people who had it immune to AIDS.
Mm-hmm.
This unexpected consequences.
Tons of them.
And
never mind that most diseases, when they have a genetic component, it's hard, it's not like a gene, which is how the public kind of thinks of these things. It's like a constellation of genes that can all interact with each other, and some subset of them can lead to one type of disease phenotype, like autism is a great example.
Describe phenotype. I don't think people know what that is.
Yeah, so that means that that's the observed trait, you know, like, so you have okay. So you have like a genetic variation, and then that leads to some kind of observed trait, but genes don't, they don't operate in a vacuum either. It's not just a matter of having the genes, what the gene does, and of course what you do, how you interact with the environment. So mm-hmm. if you're in the right environment, genes express in a certain way. If you're in a different kind of environment, genes express in an entirely different way too.
You didn't even mention epigenetics either,
yeah.
which maybe means that the environment activates. I might be wrong on this, but my understanding of epigenetics is that it's an environment activated gene that normally is latent.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, there's really, like, unintended consequences
no.
to having a blue blood package.
Yeah, there totally are. I mean, some diseases or some things are cut and dry. Like Parkinson's disease, you got one gene, mm-hmm. that's it. You have a certain number of repeats of that gene, you've got it. If you don't, you don't. But almost nothing works like that.
Yeah. That's what they teach you in elementary school. And then if you keep going, it gets more complicated.
Definitely.
Right?
That's true. Yeah.
Right. Who was the scientist with the flowers?
Mendel.
Mendel, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Mendel was considered to be hard science, and now we know it's completely not like that at all.
Yeah.
You know, Mendel is just, it was a straight probability problem as to which flowers would be which colors, and
right.
you can even apply it to things like eye color and things like that, and now we know that's not true.
Yeah, that's
way more
complicated than that.
Yeah.
Exactly.
All right. So good luck, Brazil. So now this is a killer. This is a really crazy one. You heard it here first, all right? Remember that. Apparently the Navy has confirmed that a leak from one of their fighter jets in 2014, which has a UFO depicted and the pilot's reactions to it,
okay.
is legit.
Wow.
2182 noticed.
Yep.
They're the ones who spotted it.
Right. Right. So, but it was Blink 182. They were the ones who.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So, wow. I mean, like, the Navy didn't deny it.
That's crazy.
I mean, they're not saying it's aliens. It might be aliens, but it's really an interesting thing because if it's aliens, it's either aliens or we no longer have military air superiority. And air superiority is the only thing that matters in physical warfare.
Yes.
So, the Navy just admitted that we're the losers or there's aliens. What?
That's crazy. I did not see this at all.
In hindsight, it makes total sense why they would have denied it all this time.
Yeah.
You know, if they had seen things like this before.
Sure.
What is going on? I can't even speculate. This means UFO just means, well, they called it something else, but it was, no, it's not in the URL. But whatever, who cares? So
yeah.
This was, if you want to look this up, so you know I'm not making this up, it was the Navy, 2014 was when the leak was. There was Deputy Chief of Operations of Information Warfare in the Navy. His name is Joseph Gradisher. So, and apparently it was an FA-18 that saw it.
Wow.
So, there's all the details. Go to town, have a party. Yeah, I can't believe it either. Awesome, but I've long speculated on this show that first contact is the most under-discussed topic about alien life.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, what would be the first contact protocol? Do you have any ideas about first contact protocols?
Or? I have no idea. I mean, I've thought about UFOs and extraterrestrial life and all that kind of stuff. But to think, do I think that that's ever happened here? No, I don't. But there has to be some kind of protocol.
Well, I don't think it's happened either. But
okay.
I'm definitely open to the idea that it has.
Yeah, it could.
Right.
The universe is too big.
So here's.
We can't. I don't. Yeah.
So here's. I'm going to give you. A thought pattern that I have on this, right? So when would aliens talk to people? When would
they
be
appropriate? What would their threshold be for trying to talk to us?
Star Trek, Gene Roddenberry actually covered this and dealt with this.
Right.
Right. You know. Yes. Yeah, Star Trek. All right. So and in his world, the first contact protocol was a warp drive. A made-up technology that we don't have yet, although it may be real, who knows,
right?
Eventually. And when the aliens saw the warp drive, they said, okay, they're coming anyway. Let's go down and say hi.
Right.
Right. Like the, and in that case, it was the Vulcans, right, mm-hmm. that came down and said hi to humans.
Right.
But, you know, it could be anything.
Yeah.
I mean, we don't even know if that technology is possible.
Right.
And there's no confirmation. You know, it seems, I mean, it is possible. There are things traveling faster than the speed of light in relatively speaking. They're just at the other ends of the universe.
Yeah.
Right, which is really, really far. That's a big warp field.
Yeah.
So can we shrink that warp field down? We don't know yet. Maybe. But it could be something else. It could just be, hey, what if we just include our least desirable humans in our society without punishing them for things they can't help and they were born with?
Could be something like that, too.
Like the autism thing
yeah.
that we were talking about before.
Yeah, you don't know what the criterion is.
Right.
Right.
They may have, or, you know, like it was a kind of a jesting Twilight Zone where they were talking about, you know, oh, we're not good enough at war, so they killed us. You know, I'll let you find that one on your own. But, it's possible if there is intelligent life and faster than light speed travel is possible, it's like a 50-50 shot they're already here, and they've been here trying to stay right out of the edge of our periphery the whole time.
Out of our awareness, yeah.
Out of our awareness.
Sure.
Which is also kind of depressing because it also means if, you know, they aren't here, then that's it. We're alone. But on the other hand, the universe is ours.
Yeah.
Party on, man. We just have to get there, and it's nonstop party at Alpha Centauri. So I just thought that was interesting.
Yeah.
And this one is actually from a Elon Musk tweet, which
okay.
is kind of ironic and awesome at the same time. Daimler, and if you don't know who Daimler is Mercedes' company,
right.
the company that owns Mercedes, has officially announced that they're ending internal combustion development.
That's cool.
They're moving to straight electric.
Cool.
This is Mercedes, people. So if you're into German cars and you want the best of the best, you're going to be running electric pretty soon.
Hmm.
So, yeah. This is
big. That's
huge.
Big.
So part of it is, I don't know if you heard, there was recently a thing that came out where there's a Texas company that figured out a new kind of motor where they use they change the phases in real time on the
okay.
motor, and actually what it does is it retards the motor and makes it less almost like a distributor does on a combustion engine.
Okay.
Retards the motor and makes it less powerful, so they can build a lower, lighter spec engine.
Ah.
So
to run the whole thing.
And so because it doesn't have to be duty cycle for the maximum strength all the time, they can turn the strength down.
I see. Which means your battery life is going to go up. And
your battery life doubles, apparently.
Wow.
So, yeah. Yeah.
Cool.
Huge. And it's kind of interesting. And Tesla just recently announced that they've managed to get to a 6,000 cycle, I don't know if you remember if it was a million miles, 6,000 cycle battery, which apparently translates to like some ridiculous mileage.
Wow.
Yeah, ridiculous. Or a 10-year lifespan or something, or like worst case, like so.
That's impressive.
Yeah, yeah. So we're talking. Yeah, it looks like we're maybe getting off of gasoline engines. So pick up your hot rods while you can, folks. all right, and of course I have links for everything, so I can cite them if I need them. So again. for the non-believers. All right, George Portugal, thank
all
you so
right.
much for being on.
Thank
Thanks
you.
For chiming into the news and
Absolutely.
Enduring the dystopia report.
It's very cool.
Yeah, so lots of weird stuff happening out there.
Absolutely, always.
So I totally didn't know anything about you compared
yeah.
to the little bit of time that I spent when I met you at the LI Retro Gaming Con.
Yeah.
So, LI Retro Gaming Expo.
Right.
So, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself? What's your background and
yeah.
Well, let's start with the Retro Gaming Expo. How'd you get into that?
Well, okay, so that's a bit of a long story, but I'll get into it. And
no, I like long stories. Go
yeah,
for it.
Sure. So,
we are a 3-hour show.
Okay, so we're good.
Popcorn people.
So yeah, I've been into gaming for forever, pretty much.
Right.
And my background, like I said before, is that I'm a scientist. So what I formerly was trained in is neuroscience. So I did a PhD in neuroscience at Temple, and then I did a postdoc at Columbia, and then afterwards I left academia. Now I'm working in industry. And so in that background, you know, I've had to learn a whole bunch of different techniques. So I had to learn how to do some basic soldering, make some amplifiers, and, you know, custom things for work, because, you know, if you work as a scientist, you have to kind of do that stuff.
Right. And particularly at B&L, there was a whole... Well, actually, at B&L, maybe that... So I used to work at Brookhaven National Labs like an age ago. And they so they have the collider ring. So there's a whole department of people who are just electronic engineers who specialize in building equipment to get readouts from the ring as they smash particles into each other.
Yeah.
So, you know, like this, pretty much you're going to have to, if you're anywhere near the cutting edge of your craft, you're going to have to build something.
It's inevitable. I mean, part of what you do, you get things off the shelf, but then, yeah, you have ideas, you have questions, there's no commercial off-the-shelf way to do it, and so you've got to figure out how to implement it yourself. And so, you know, in that experience as a scientist, I learned a fair amount about electronics. And so, yeah, I've been gaming forever. I love video games. And I started getting into repair not really that long ago, like 3 or 4 years ago, really. And it started with me just finding... I was helping my parents clean out their basement, and I found my Game Boy from childhood. And I actually had two, so the first one that...
Wait, hold on a second. You had a Game Boy, and now you have a PhD. It didn't ruin your life?
No, it did not ruin my life. It didn't turn me into a murderer. It didn't turn me into a degenerate. I'm fine.
Well,
well, okay, maybe.
No, well, you definitely hang out with degenerates at least.
Okay.
It's your Game Boy.
Yeah, so I found two of them. I found the one that I broke as a kid, and then I found the working one that my parents got to me after I, you know, begged and pleaded for another one.
Right.
So when I found the broken one, I was like, well, you know, I could just toss this, but maybe I can do something different with it, something fun or interesting. And so I started thinking and reading, and so then, you know, I got to one of these guys. I started learning about Raspberry Pis and emulation and that people...
Random prop. Didn't know that.
No, you didn't, but it's perfect.
Yeah.
So people have found all sorts of interesting ways of making those portable, and so I got a Raspberry Pi Zero, and there's a whole community of people who mess with them and make them portable.
Right.
So I turned my Game Boy into a portable Pi Zero with like about 10,000 games and a whole bunch of, you know, extra buttons and all that kind of stuff. So that's kind
awesome.
Of yeah. So that's
yeah. There's a ton of if you're looking out there, there's a ton of things sets that you can buy to make it easier to help you along, so you can make your own little video game console out of Raspberry Pi.
That's right. This was kind of earlier, though, so at the time it was more, yeah, homemade.
Yeah.
But nowadays you're correct. It's way easier to do now what I did like a couple years ago.
Right. You were one of the trailblazers.
Early, like, yeah. I was kind of.
What year was this that you were doing that?
I don't know, like 2015 or not that long ago.
Right.
But yeah, at that time there weren't kits. It was just DIY.
Okay. Cool.
Yeah, and so that kind of, you know, led to other ideas, other projects, repairs, modifications of systems, and eventually I found this Long Island Retro Gaming Facebook page, which has about 4,000 members, and I joined and started just sharing my work, and people were excited about it and kept bringing me things, new projects, and it just kind of cascaded. And
so, what's the name of that site? Is it still up, or?
Yeah, it's part of the it's a Facebook group. It's called Long Island Retro Gaming.
Oh, and okay. So you were part of one of the original members of the Long Island Retro Gaming Expo.
Well, no. So the expo was tied to that group, and so at some point, you know, Joel Albino, the owner of the Long Island Retro Gaming Expo, you know, reached out to me and said, hey, you know, we have a bunch of, you know, broken systems or, you know, things like that. Would you be interested in joining us and being a part of the expo? And at that point, I was like, yeah, of course. And it's been a wonderful experience. I mean, I've only been working with them for a year, but, you know, in that time, we've been able to do a lot of stuff. I mean, I probably repaired well over 30 or 40 systems for them, so that they have a large free play area where people can come and just play all sorts of games, whether they're modern or, you know, from the very beginning of video game history.
Right. I was running around doing videotaping it, and I met you there.
Yeah, that's how we met.
Yeah, and I heard that there was this mysterious guy. At first, I didn't know it was you, because I assumed you had a cloak and a wizard's hat on, from the way people described you, that had done some wondrous thing with some old machine.
Yeah.
But and then I'm like, oh, this guy seems pretty cool, and I'm like, there's something special about him. And you want to tell me, so that you had fixed a video game for them, right?
It was a particularly
special video game.
Yeah, so it was an extraordinary opportunity. I mean, it really was. So the Cradle of Aviation Museum is where the expo takes place every year. And because they have an affiliation with Brookhaven Labs, where where some of the very first video games were developed, Brookhaven allows them to fund some things related to arcade machines.
Right, that was Pong, if you're wondering what he's talking about.
No, before Pong. It was called Tennis for Two, which was on an oscilloscope in the late 50s. But yes, it's a Pong kind of game.
Yeah, Pong.
Yeah.
The early predecessor of Pong, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Sorry, Pong is trademarked. Please don't sue me. We're just a stupid show.
That's right. It's all good. So the museum has funding for arcade machines, and they have about, I don't know, 30 or so arcade machines. And they managed to get a really special one called Computer Space. And this one is special because it is the very first commercially made video game. It was made back in 1971, and it was made by this guy named Nolan Bushnell. And after he made this, he quit his job and founded Atari. So some of the people who are listening may know this guy. And
right.
he made Pong and really was one of the founding fathers of the whole video gaming industry. Yeah.
Okay.
So it's really the very beginnings. Prior to this, there were video games, but they were, you know, like they were oddball one-off occurrences. Like you could go to MIT and on a $500,000 PDP mainframe computer you could play a game called Space War. And so, you know, a very small subset of people could play these new things called video games, but it was definitely not publicly available at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So Bushnell and this guy Ted Dabney, they created this game. It was the very first arcade. There was maybe about 1,000 to 1,500 that were ever made, ballpark. No one really knows the exact number.
Mm-hmm.
Probably surviving in the world today, there's maybe 200 or so left, definitely. Maybe more than that, but at least documented,
right.
There's about 200. And,
right.
Yeah. And this one is one of them. And so Joel connected me up, Joel who runs the expo, connected me up with the museum, and he was like, you know, we've got this arcade machine. Do you want to take a look at it?
So just so you know, like, when you see this thing, it's ridiculous. So it doesn't look like marketing people were talked to at all.
No.
It looks like a giant banana.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. It's all made out of fiberglass. It looks like a big bowling ball, honestly. It's all sparkly and doesn't it?
It has that weird scope.
And it has this kind of dome where the image comes out of, and you've got this like this kind of four button controller that just kind of oozes out the bottom of it. And it doesn't look like any arcade machine you've ever seen. It like really screams 1970s. It's like you know?
Right, right.
Yeah.
It kind of looks like it's curvy like a Corvette a little bit.
Yes.
Like the C3 was it? Was the C3 the one with the fiberglass body that everybody lost it after? The original Barbie one.
Yeah, that's right. It's totally crazy. It's a crazy design. And so it just...
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
C3. Yes. Okay.
Yeah, so just...
It looks a bit like a yellow C3 Corvette.
Yeah.
With a viewfinder from like a submarine on it.
Yeah, that's right. It's just an unreal...
Yeah, look it up. It's crazy.
It's really cool. So Joel connected me up with the museum and was like, this was in July, and meanwhile the expo was in August, so it was like about a month, and they were like, you know, do you want to take a look at this thing and see if you can fix it? Because at this point I'd fixed or modified, like I said, lots of stuff. So I went to the museum, I took a look at it, and it was crazy because you know, it was...
What kind of CPU was in there?
Well, yeah, so this is the interesting thing. This is from a time when computers were prohibitively expensive. Bushnell, when him and Ted Dabney were working on developing this thing, the first thing they wanted to do was make it with a computer. And they really very quickly realized that was never going to happen because these things were going to cost like $20,000 a pop. They'd never make their money. But after more testing and experimentation, they realized that they could make something very similar to a computer game using discrete logic chips. So Ted Dabney was the one who figured out how to manipulate pixels on a CRT display, and then so he was dealing with the analog component of this,
right.
and then Nolan Bushnell was dealing with the discrete logic component of this.
So the CRT display, you're talking about the old tube displays,
yeah,
like the TVs and the
yeah. So again, this was like a time before arcade monitors existed, you know. So they literally just took a off the shelf GE television and they hacked it. And they modified it so that it could accept composite video. And then they just started messing around with stuff. And eventually, you know, after about a good year or two of development, they had this arcade in place. And it's if you look at the back of it, it has three gigantic logic boards with like maybe 150 discrete logic chips, all off-the-shelf parts.
Right.
And so there's no CPU, there's nothing proprietary in there. It's just that plus a hacked TV, literally a paint bucket for collecting the coins, and I think the coin mechanism is something they picked out of like a washing machine or something like that. So it's all
like a laundromat.
Yeah,
coin.
Yeah.
Well, I guess it wouldn't be anything else.
Exactly.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I kid you not, that is what they did. So the inside is all like DIY hack job, and then the outside is this crazy fiberglass shell.
Wow.
Yeah.
Was there any handwritten notes in the inside of it all?
I will get to that, but yes, there were.
Oh, okay. Cool. Interesting.
Yeah. So I got to look at the machine, and this is not like, so the problem with working on something this old is that looking at more modern works don't necessarily help you, because you come to expect certain things, like fixing a Nintendo or an Atari 2600, like there's easy documentation, well-described everything.
Right.
This is all hand-drawn and badly written and poorly documented, and so trying to...
So how do you solve that? I mean, do you get in their heads? Is
that well, it's hard. So
what were they thinking? You know, have a seance and try to...
Yeah, I had to do... Before I actually started in July, I knew about this machine, and so even before I started talking to the museum, did a lot of homework. So thankfully other people have fixed this thing aside from me, and I was able to see what they did and get a feel for how they took apart the machine and how they solved problems. And so, I mean, even without knowing what problems I would face, I, you know, thankfully some of this stuff is documented on the internet and I was able to find that. But some of the design quirks about this machine also work to my advantage, because there is nothing proprietary. It's all discrete logic chips, and you can buy all that stuff today.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew that whatever is wrong, you know, no matter how severe or minor, at least I can get a modern replacement and pop it in, and it'll work. So some of that.
Encouraged
me.
So you're approaching this problem.
Yeah.
And you're looking at it like, okay, what can I fix and what can't I fix?
Right.
And you realize, okay, if these chips are burnt out, I know how to get these chips.
That's right. Yeah, all the components can be found.
Right.
And so that is encouraging, at least. And there are schematics, even though they're junk, they're there.
Right.
And even...
So what do you mean when they say the schematics are junk? What's junky about them?
They're written in a way that you really can't even... You can't decipher them. Like, there's normal... Like, for example, like, if you've got a...
I remember, like, old schematics. I mean, I think it was a requirement at one point. Because you remember there was a lot of old Radio Shack stuff would come with schematics. And,
yes.
You know, I remember they would say solid state up in the corner.
Yeah.
And it was a certain way, you know, transistors had one symbol.
Well, see, that's part of the problem. The symbols don't match up to what normal symbols are. Like, you see what I mean? Like, that's...
There's no symbols yet.
Yeah.
When they built them.
Yeah, the symbols don't make sense. There are chunks of the circuit that are actually irrelevant, that just exist, that, like... And not only that, this thing was a work in progress. It's not like Bushnell and Dabney made a board and that was the board for the life of it. If you look at early boards versus later boards, they kept, you know, bodging things, modifying things, making it better. So that's another problem. Like when you're talking about computer space, every machine is unique in some way.
So, so they're like, it's like a Ferrari, hand-built and guaranteed to break down more often.
Hey, totally.
Yes.
Yeah. So
Ford was not totally useless.
No. So yeah. Yeah. So this is what I faced, and this is before I even looked at the machine. So then I finally get to looking at the machine, and so it's a mess, because, you know, it clearly hasn't worked in decades.
Right.
It's coated in dust. There are capacitors that are visibly blown.
Right.
But the biggest problem...
Do they have the brown stains, you know?
Yeah.
The shit stain, as they call it.
The shit stain all over. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's great. And then I look at the TV, and the TV is... A, it's a vacuum tube TV, which I've never touched in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And B, it has its own circuit board, which is literally shattered in like 15 pieces. So someone at some point dropped the television, obliterated it. And so I'm like, okay, I can't even look at the board because I have no way to look at it. Like, there's no TV, no nothing.
Right.
So I'm already off to a shitty start here.
Right.
but, you know, I try to, again, do my homework, do a lot of research, and I had also a little bit of luck. So in the course of doing my research, like I said a few minutes ago, I figured out that, you know, what these guys did was basically make a composite video and audio signal and feed that into this hacked television. So I thought to myself, well, why don't I just take these cables and connect them up to a TV that has composite video and see what happens. Before I did that, I was like, all right, well, the caps are clearly crap. Let me take all those out and put
the capacitors. Right?
Yeah, sorry.
No,
yeah.
It's fine. I know what you meant, but
yeah, so the capacitors had blown, and that's not at all surprising. Those things have a lifespan of 20 years. This thing is almost 50 years old. Yeah. So
solid state, yes. Keep going.
Yeah. Yeah, so I took those all out. I put them, you know, put in modern replacements, which is easy enough to do.
Right.
And so then once I did that, I took the thankfully easily defined, you know, video, audio, and ground, and I rigged up a little thing where I could connect those up, and on the other end I could have standard, you know, composite video and audio jacks.
Mm-hmm.
I plugged them into a television, and amazingly I had a signal. I had a video signal. It was not working properly because, like, the signal was rolling. In other words, like, the television wasn't synchronizing up to it.
Right, right. But you could see that there was a pattern.
Yeah,
I could
see stars. I could see. I heard sound, and not only that, when I pressed the controls, stuff happened. Like, I could hear, you know, like when the missile fired. I could hear when the ship rotated. So it was like, holy shit! It's like not dead.
It's alive.
Yeah, so right. So it was extremely encouraging.
How many times have you been electrocuted at this point?
On this particular project, thankfully none. But
okay.
I've been electrocuted plenty.
Oh,
yeah,
okay.
But nothing crazy. I mean, at least I know.
Right, right.
I know enough to be.
Well, you're here, so it couldn't have been 440 or anything like that.
No, nothing like that. Oh my God, no. So this is where things were like good, and I was like thinking like this actually might be ready by August, which I was not expecting at all. I was thinking this was going to be some long term project.
Next year.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah,
totally. So then this is the part of the story where a little bit of serendipity helped. So I knew that my problem was I need a TV.
Right.
That TV was shit. It was never going to come back, or so I thought.
Right.
So I need a TV. And the problem is that this is not just some normal TV. This is a vacuum tube television from 1971, a very specific model. And people know what this TV is. If it ever comes onto the market working, they sell for thousands of dollars.
No, oh, okay.
Because other people who have busted computer spaces buy them up.
thanks, eBay.
Yeah.
Yeah, free market this.
Yeah, the last one on eBay, I think, went for, maybe $1,700.
Holy cow.
Yeah. I'm not kidding. I mean, seriously. Look
how much we're talking about this silly old banana video game.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
it's really important.
Yeah. So
it's important to Earth.
Yeah, it is important to Earth.
Computer space
is all, yeah.
It's important to Earth, because without computer space, you can't save Earth. Anyway, but keep going.
Yeah, so, all right, so I had to figure out something, and I thought, let me see if I can find a TV that's not the official TV, but works.
Right.
So I did some sleuthing around the internet, and I lucked out. I found a TV serviceman's guidebook from the early 70s that someone just freaking uploaded to the internet. And I searched through it, and it had like a whole list of GE televisions. I found the one, the Adventurer 3, which is the one that Computer Space uses. But thankfully, this book had a section with a whole bunch with the same chassis. Like, they're all in the same family, which means that the boards are either identical or extremely similar. So now I had like 20 names of televisions that I could search on eBay or some other place to find a replacement.
Nice.
Yeah. And
huge change.
Huge change. And then I searched, and as luck would have it, there was literally only one. It was in Albany, which is a 3-hour drive from here, and it was $75. I was like, fuck, let me get this like now.
Right, right.
I bought it immediately.
Right, right.
And it was working. They had images of it with static on, and it was claimed to be working, and it was. It came to my house like 3 days later, I turned it on, and it worked. And so then, like, you know, I went back to the museum, and they couldn't believe what I had. And then we were like, you know, thinking, okay, let's just swap televisions. You know, like, I wasn't thinking about doing anything more complicated than that, because I was like, I've got a working TV. All I need to do now is hack it for composite video, just like Bushnell and Dabney did.
So how do you hack that TV for composite video? Is it way too complicated to describe?
No, it's actually really simple. So What they did is they basically cut out the UHF and VHF tuner, which is what the television normally received. And so what that's standard RF video when you used to have like your antenna up on your TV, and it would receive a radio broadcast of whatever channel you were interested in. So
literally those old channel dials used to be resistors, right?
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So that's what the TV is looking for video and audio input. You just cut that part of the circuit off, and then you just feed in composite audio and video in the right places where that tuner would have gone in.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So you just need to know what the inputs into the actual tube are.
Exactly.
And off to the races.
And I didn't even really have to think about this, because even though the original board was trashed, the composite hack remained.
Mm-hmm.
And so I could see where they were going in, and I could replicate that. And so then when I took, I have the two TVs side, well, let me back up a little bit, because I took out the TV, and like I said, the original plan was simple, swap TVs. But when I took the TV out of computer space, somebody had written something on top of the TV. And so this was the part you were asking is there something interesting in there? And this was unexpected. So somebody at some point in the life of this thing...
Some sort of Ready Player One Easter egg for real life.
Yes. Yeah, totally. So on the top of the TV, somebody wrote with a permanent ink marker, computer space TV on the top. And it was very funny, because like it just changed all of us. We saw that and we were like, fuck, like, you know, who wrote this? Could have been like some technician. It could have just been some arcade guy. But it could have been Nolan Bushnell. It could have been Ted Dabney. Because it's not like the company that they were working for, it was called Nutting Associates. It was some small arcade amusement operation, you know, it could have been from that time period. And so seeing that just changed everything. We were like, that's the TV.
Right.
Not this other TV. So we're going to take this TV and we're going to fix the original TV.
Right. Wow, okay. That's a bold move. So you've got a broken TV, a working TV, and a broken tube.
Yeah.
And you decided, okay, we're going to dismantle the working tube and fix the broken
tube. So it was a very high risk, high reward idea, and it was completely irrational, but it was seeing that on the TV, we're like,
"Fuck."
You were
in love, weren't you?
I was. I'm not kidding you, man. It was like.
I get it.
You know, like, this thing's a piece of history. This thing's gonna work. I'm gonna do this. It was just crazy.
Tie something around your head, you know. All right, let's go.
Yeah. So then we just prepped for surgery, basically, and you know, took the two TVs, laid them out side by side. We took the top off of, or the back rather, off of the donor television, and we were like, we couldn't believe how perfect it was. It was a 1-to-1 match. The broken PCB was a perfect match to the original one.
Right.
Color coded and everything. So I didn't actually have to think about it. All I had to do was just label all the connections, cut everything, transplant, and then solder them all back together.
Right.
And I mean, that took time, and I had to be very meticulous and careful about it and make sure I had enough cable, because like another thing was that the donor was a slightly smaller television, and so I had to make sure that there was enough length of wire so that I could make this thing fit.
Mm-hmm.
So I did that. And then I desoldered the wires that were used for the composite hack. I popped those into the new TV.
Mm-hmm.
And then after...
So what gauge wire was typically used in there?
Yeah, it ranges. Like, some parts are higher voltage, and they had, like, thicker, maybe, like, 16-gauge wire.
Like, now, like, most people, you may not know if you're, you know, if you haven't really dabbled too much in electronics. Electronics used to be a lot bigger.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Like, circuits were bigger.
Everything
solder points were bigger.
They were massive.
You could kind of have gorilla hands and solder.
You could.
You know?
Yeah.
Now, forget it. This is some things you just, if you don't have the right specialized, like, vacuum-based heat gun kind of equipment, you can't remove chips or anything.
Some of the stuff I do is under a microscope because I need to.
Right.
Yeah, on other work. But this, you're right. You can have gorilla hands and it's fine.
Yeah, I mean, I know because I have gorilla hands, so, you know.
And this thing on the bottom, it's like crazy. The PCB,
Phil,
it's like
a huge risk because you could have burnt something out and you would never be able to diagnose what.
No.
Well, you might be able to.
But I had this. I had this like once in a lifetime TV, and I was willing to throw it away so that I could save the original. So it was crazy. But I had to do it. I just had to. And it wasn't. It was like funny because it wasn't just me pushing this. It was like four or five guys from the museum, and we were like, we're doing this.
To save a tube with a signature on top of the tube that no one was ever going to see, but you knew it was real.
Yes.
Yeah, that's
the thing. Yeah, you wouldn't see this. You can't see this from the machine. You have to take the TV out to see this.
Right.
Of course, I got photos. I can share some of that stuff with you, too, if you want.
Sure.
Yeah. So we did this all this work. I plugged in the TV for the first time. The vacuum tubes glowed, but I saw nothing. So I was like, fuck. And of course, I just didn't flip a power switch like an idiot.
Nice. Is it plugged in? Really? Did you just check again?
Yeah. Yeah.
So I worked in IT. You know, you always got to make sure it's plugged in.
Of course.
Yeah. Is it on?
Yeah.
Everybody does it.
Everybody does it. It
doesn't matter if you're a CCIE. Sooner or later, you don't turn it on.
No, at some point you're going to do it.
Yep.
Yeah. So we did the right thing, turned on the stupid switch, and it came alive. And, you know, we had to adjust the dials, and at first the image was blurry, but with some more time and I think the TV had to, like, kind of burn in, but eventually we got a nice, clean image of computer space for the very first time. And so this was, like, the first time where I could actually look at the game and see if it had more problems, because I knew a lot already. I knew it had video, I knew it had audio, and I knew it had controls.
Right.
But
so this is just for people who are not familiar with, like, you know, trying to diagnose a problem either in software or in hardware.
Yeah.
You know, like, having a running program or having a running piece of hardware, even if it's running really badly, is 1,000 times better than having
nothing.
Silence.
Yes.
You know, just complete inoperability, because you don't know what the heck's wrong.
Yeah.
But, like, now you can test. You can systematically try this, try this.
Yeah, I'm not blind anymore.
Try this, yeah.
Yeah.
You're not just taking educated guesses. You can do a binary search tree, you know, and kind of like, okay, this, nope, this, nope, this, nope.
Right.
Fix it.
Exactly. Right. Like,
yeah.
I mean, computer space, like I said, has shitty schematics. But if I saw behavior with, like, say, the UFOs in the game, then I know at least where to look. I have a place to start. And
right.
So until that moment, I had nowhere to go. But then, I mean, to my amazement, it didn't have any other problems. It worked. It, like all those frickin' logic chips, those 50-year-old logic chips.
What about all those shit stains on the boards?
It didn't do any damage. Yeah. I'm not kidding you.
Everything was so over-engineered.
Yeah.
It worked anyway.
No, it worked anyway. I mean, I cleaned up all the shit stains and whatever. And,
right.
You know, but it didn't, yeah, the traces were solid. All those logic chips were still solid. 50 years later, the game behaved like it was supposed to. And that also took time, too. Like, I had to find videos of this game working, because, again, so few of these work. Like, maybe less than 50
right.
in the world still work.
Now it's 51.
Yeah, now it's 51. Right. Yeah, that's right.
So what is it like? What is it like playing this game?
It's a weird kind of game, because in some ways it's like Asteroids. So basically it's a one-player game. You control a flying saucer, and I'm sorry, you control a rocket ship, and your goal is to shoot these two flying saucers that float around on the screen. And the enemies have a score, you have a score, and you have about 90 seconds in which to compete against them. And if you win, you get a bonus time where the colors invert, so space becomes white, the stars become black, all the pixels become black.
Nice.
And then you get another chance to kick their ass for another 90 seconds. So that's basically how the game works. It's kind of like Asteroids, but without the asteroids.
Wow. So
yeah.
there's not even any kind of reward sequence at all.
No.
Right.
No. So like
in video games, like, people don't really analyze this or think about it, but in more modern video games, even, and when I say more modern, I'm talking like Pac-Man.
Yeah, even Pac-Man, sure.
You know, like, or Space Invaders or something. There's a reward when you succeed. In the case of the older arcade games, it tends to be a harder version of the game you just played.
Right.
Right, they make it more difficult. And in more modern games, it's cutscenes and stuff like that.
Exactly.
But, like, there's nothing.
No, there's nothing.
You have successfully defended the Earth. There was only four UFOs, right?
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah.
It's even, you know, what's even more interesting, there's all these quirks about the game. So, because of the nature of the logic chips they used, it's also incapable of counting score past the number 9.
Really?
Yes, that's right.
My God. How many bits is that? What is that, 3 bits? No, wait, hold on. So 0, 1, 4, 8. No, that's 4 bits.
It's only got 4 bits.
Wow, that's
yeah,
crazy.
Yeah, so you can be in a situation with this game where, like, let's just say you've got a score of 2, and the aliens are kicking your ass, okay? And
yeah.
They've got 9 points. And if you can get them to hit you one more time before time runs out, they go back to 0, and now suddenly you're winning because you've got 2 and they've got 0.
Nice. Right, ludicrous speed. Okay.
Exactly.
You flip around a ludicrous speed.
Yeah. So it's just a really funny game like that. There's all these other weird quirks, too, because you have four controls. You can thrust to move forward, you can fire, and then you can rotate. And what's
the controls are really wonky.
They are. They're ass backwards from what you're used to.
Right.
So, like, firing is on your left hand and thrusting, and then turning is on your right hand. And so playing the game the first time, you're going to get your ass kicked because you're intuitively, you're expecting something like Asteroids, and you don't.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but then what's even weirder is that eventually you learn that you can control the bullets. So rotate not only rotates your ship, it rotates your bullets. So so you can fire in completely wrong places. Oh, yeah, sure.
See with the coffee, what?
I read the look on your faces. You might want to move your hands.
No, that's all right. It's fine.
If I burn you, it's not my fault.
Eventually, I'll have a callus right here from being singed on the show.
Oh, my goodness.
Because that's the metal way to handle it. Yeah.
That's right.
Right.
So because of the quirks of the game, if you rotate the ship, you also rotate the bullets. But you can kind of use that to your advantage, and you can just, oh, yeah, thanks.
I think I saw you use sugar before.
Yeah, thank you.
All right.
So if you miss, you can kind of tweak your bullets and point them back in the direction of the enemy and hit them, whereas they're dumb, and they just fire straight, and so you can still dodge their attacks. And so,
right.
Yeah, so eventually the game becomes a cakewalk if you play it enough.
Right. So what you're saying is that it's not the pinnacle of AI.
No. But actually, since you mentioned AI, I think this is maybe the first or one of the first games that has an AI at all.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, because
cool.
All of the earlier examples are two-player affairs. Like, there's a game called Space War, which is basically plays like this.
So is this, as far as you know, this is the first game where you actually play against the computer and not against another person?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that it is.
That's amazing.
It is. I'm almost certain that it's the first game where you fight the computer
I just fixed it, but still, you fixed it! Holy cow!
I know.
It was, so we can know that.
Yeah.
We wouldn't know that if you hadn't fixed it.
No, I know. It's just, it was an amazing, like, really amazing month getting that thing working and getting it done, like, with 1 week to spare before the show. And then having thousands of people have the, like, it was 5,000 people who came and that they could see this thing that, you know, almost no one gets a chance to see.
Right. I'm sure a lot of them reacted the same way I did, like, what is that?
Oh, yeah. A lot of people did. Yeah, a lot of people did.
So this is like a huge extravaganza, this show. So, you said you had 30 physical arcades and you have a whole bunch of consoles in there.
Oh, yeah. So you know, the show is about all things retro gaming. And so we try to cater to lots of different people and have all sorts of different experiences for people. So we have an enormous free play section where people can have a chance to play all sorts of systems, whether it's the stuff you grew up with a kid or something crazy and obscure like Computer Space. Mm-hmm. We have now like a historical retrospective that we call the Ring of History, where we start with Computer Space and we go all the way into the modern era, and we've got an example of every system.
Mm-hmm.
There's an enormous merchant area where you can buy, sell, trade anything to your heart's content. There's competitions, there's panelists, there's all sorts of people in cosplay. I mean, you name it, it's got everything.
It is a wonderful, happy, loving feel-at-home circus.
Yeah, it really is.
You know, that you're in. You're not in the audience, you're in it.
Yeah, so. It goes so fast, too. I mean, this is the third one that I've attended, but this is the first one where I actually helped make it happen. And it feels so good to, like, you know, work on this kind of stuff over the course of a year and then have, like I said, thousands of people enjoy stuff. And
I'm a huge fan. I'm a proponent of local cons and, you know, like, I mean, like, I'm not against the corporate cons. They're good, too.
Yeah, sure.
But, like, I mean, there's just nothing like having, you know, everybody, you know, it's like, it's kind of like meeting your neighbors, you know,
it,
in a way.
It is.
It really is. These are the people who have your interests who live near you.
Yeah.
And you just, you know, you want to just keep meeting them and talking to them and stuff.
Exactly.
Right.
I mean, before then, you know, before I found all these people, I was still doing cool stuff, but I was doing it in a vacuum. I didn't have a community to share with and help and also learn from. And
speaking of the vacuum, whatever happened to your Game Boy? You never told me what happened to it.
Oh, yeah.
So it got you into the Raspberry Pi. Did you actually repair it, or?
Well, yeah, so it was not repairable. It was obliterated, but I wanted to still put it to use. So the shell ended up getting used. Some parts of, I took as much of the circuit board as I could.
Oh, you made your Pi Zero look like a Game Boy.
Yes.
Nice!
Yes,
you got it functioning to as far as anyone can tell, it's a GameCube.
Yeah, so it has like a SNES style control, so it has like four buttons in the front, and it's got L and R triggers on the back.
Had you ever seen that before when you did it?
Yeah. Okay. So I wasn't like inventing this. There was precedent for this, but still I had to.
It was still pretty rare though.
Yeah, it was still pretty rare. I had to like make my own PCB. I had to learn how to program a microcontroller.
Now it's different. Now they sell sticker kits. The cheap way is you do it with stickers, right? Like you get more horsepower with your Pep Boy stickers in your car. You get a sticker kit on Amazon, and you put it on, you make your console look like a retro console.
Totally.
Yeah. But that's really awesome. I really love. I was obsessed with Game Boys when I was young. I did not have one. I was very jealous of the people who did.
That was one of the first. It was a big one for me. It was a lot of fun. Yeah. And so to bring this busted one back to life and make it unique, and then sharing it also inevitably lended to people saying, "Hey, make me one," or "Can you make me one?" Blah blah blah. I don't even know how many at this point.
Really?
Yeah, I've made plenty of them.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So
that's great.
So
yeah.
That's cool.
I mean, I want to tell people that, because who knows how many people could hear this now.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. Yeah. You could. Yeah. I mean, it's a double-edged sword because like I love doing this kind of work, but then every time I post something new, I get and it's fine, but I get lots of people who have.
Well, you know what?
Yeah.
You know, he really does love this. So when I found you in at the expo, you were actually telling people, you were offering to them, that you would help them if they had an old console that needed repair.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I mean, that is just like, at the time I was just like, how is this guy even willing to do that? And now I just see it's just part of who you are.
It's part, yeah, exactly.
You love it that much.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it wasn't just small talk. He had a soldering station with all the electronic components.
I had all my gear there. Yeah.
Right next to computer space, and said, "Come on over and I'll fix your stuff."
Yeah, and people brought me, I don't even know how much stuff, like 20 or 30 systems that I fixed over the course of the weekend. It was ridiculous. It was ridiculous. Yeah.
Oh, that's crazy.
It was crazy. And
yeah, if you made me fix that many game systems, I mean, not that I would know how to.
Yeah.
I mean, it would take me that long to figure out how to fix one, maybe. But like, even if you made me do that much, you might have to set up suicide nets outside for me. So
it was intense. It was really intense. But I did have help. It wasn't by myself. But
right.
but I was running the show. And it's not about a business for me or anything like that. It's because I love doing it. I don't care. You know, like I need. Yeah, it's.
What's your favorite console to work on?
Oh man, that's a tough one.
What's the best laid out? What is like, okay, they really thought this through.
Yeah. So two of the ones that are, I mean, I don't get to work on them often because they're so damn robust, but like the Nintendo 64 and the original NES.
Oh, okay.
Are like, they're tanks. They are so well engineered.
Oh my god, I see that NES dropped in the floor, thrown,
yes.
Drunken stumbles.
Yeah.
You know, just give the cartridge a and stick it in and it works.
Exactly. Yeah, they're extremely robust. Like they, not only that, they're well labeled. They're documented really well. So they're a pleasure to work on. And I don't work on them often because they don't break too often.
Right.
Yeah. But I mean, for me, like the kinds of ones that I enjoy are the challenges. Like I mean, I'm totally, fixing them is great no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
But what I like is being pushed. I don't like just doing the same thing in and out. And so whenever I find something new that's exciting and fun, mm-hmm. I'm all over it.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah, so I was gonna, I think, segue into this at some point, but one of the nice things about the expo is that
segues are stick here.
Okay.
So yes, yeah, we Isaac started it, and we have we segue often.
Uh-huh.
And actually the best part is it turns out that the owner last owner of Segway died when his Segway went off a cliff.
That's
I kid you not. So yes.
Oh man.
Yes, he fact checked it. It's true.
Wow.
Yes.
Awesome.
So, good segue. Keep going.
Sure. So one of the things that's great about the expo that, for me personally, was just meeting all sorts of cool people. You know, I met you. I met like, dozens of really interesting people. And and one of the people that I got to meet, he stopped by and he knew exactly what computer space was. And he couldn't believe it because I don't think he'd ever seen one before, nor see one working. And so, and he was a huge Atari fan. And because I was there, I talked to anybody who came by and told him about it, and whatever. And so, in the course of talking to him, revealed to me that he had an original Atari Pong arcade machine from 1972. So this is like the very first Pong.
Right.
And
first commercial Pong. Not talking about the oscilloscope one at B&L, but the
right.
one that you pop quarters into.
Right. And, yeah. and people mistakenly think that this is the first video game, and rightfully so, because this was the first hit. Like, this game was a smash hit. Like, this was the first thing Atari made. They sold at least 10,000 of these arcade machines. It made them a pile of money. It got their name on the map. Mm-hmm. And it got video games on the map, and lots of other companies started popping up being like, hey, this is a moneymaker, let's
pizza
do this.
Pizza places everywhere went, what? We don't have to do stupid pinball. This is half the size and twice the money.
And it
we're in!
Exactly, exactly, exactly. It was a huge thing. It was a revolution.
Right.
So when I heard he had a Pong and that I had just fixed computer space, I was like, hell yeah. And, of course, it didn't work.
No.
But, yeah, so in the course of working on it, though, I learned that not only is it Pong, which is...
Does this Pong work, by the way?
It does now. I fixed it.
That's so awesome.
Yeah, so it works.
You got to con him into letting him to bring it into the show.
It's coming. You're gonna
it
see.
Is?
You're gonna see it next year.
Has anyone heard this yet?
No.
You heard it here first,
yes,
people.
Yes, you heard it here first.
What? Cool. Awesome. Good
yes.
job. Thanks so much.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thanks for sharing that with us.
Yeah, but it gets better. It gets better. It's not just Pong. This particular Pong has a story. It is a part of video game history, independent of the fact that it's Pong.
Right.
Okay. So, this thing has had two owners. It has the current owner and another guy. This other guy, his name is David Ahl, and anybody who's in the audience who knows anything about early video gaming history, this guy has a role in that. So he founded a magazine called Creative Computing in the 70s, and I think it went until maybe the 90s.
Creative Computing, okay.
Yeah, so it was one of the very first publications about computers, and it was the first one that was like commercially successful and popular. And so David was at the very forefront of the infancy of the modern era of computing and the infancy of video games. And so he knew about Tanis for Two at Brookhaven Labs. He knew Nolan Bushnell personally. And it was his machine. And the way that he got it was through a lawsuit. So...
Speaking of lawyers... Continue.
Yeah. So, okay. So when Pong, you know, came out and was a massive success, it was not the first table tennis game. There were
right.
others that predated it.
I have so many questions. Yeah, keep going.
Yeah.
Tell this story first, then I'll come back to it.
So there was another guy named Ralph Baer, mm-hmm. and he created a video game console called the Magnavox Odyssey. It was the very first home console. And this home console had a table tennis game. And as it turns out, Nolan Bushnell went to some kind of tech demo or some kind of thing that Magnavox was hosting before the release of the Odyssey, and he saw this table tennis.
Mm-hmm.
And so when he founded his company, he hired this new engineer called Al Alcorn, and he said, as a training assignment, make me a table tennis game. This guy made Pong, and it was so good, they were like, we're going to commercialize this. We're going to make this into a product. And so as soon as this thing became a smash hit, Ralph Baer and Magnavox were like, F you, we're suing you, you're infringing on our copyright. And so there was a big lawsuit related to this. And so Nolan Bushnell basically hired this guy David Ahl to be a court-appointed expert witness in this case to say that, look, neither of these companies have created these table tennis games. There's a precedent all the way back in the late 50s. This guy Wally Higginbotham mm-hmm. at Brookhaven Labs made Tennis for Two, this oscilloscope-based game, which is the same idea. In the end, the two companies settled out of court, and Atari became a licensee of Magnavox. I think they shelled out like $1.5 million or something like that. And at the time, when all this got settled, you know, Nolan Bushnell and Atari were tight on cash. And so instead of paying David with money, they paid him with a Pong machine, this Pong machine.
What? That is crazy.
Yeah. Isn't that crazy?
The one you just fixed.
The one I just fixed.
Nice.
Yeah. So it's been in David's possession for most of his life. And at some point, he had it as a full-size cabinet. And at some point, he moved from a larger place in Massachusetts to a smaller place in Jersey. When that happened, he didn't have room for the arcade machine anymore. So rather than sell it, he consolized it. So he cut out the entire arcade cabinet. And so now it's actually like a small little thing that fits on the desk, but it still has the original front panel, the original controls, and all of the original electronics.
Considering how close he, how intertwined he is with the whole history, that probably made it more valuable, not less.
Yes.
So it's a one-off.
Yes, it's an absolute one-off. And you'll never see a system like this again. It has like 400 plays, and that's also extremely rare. Like, to have so little play time on a Pong,
right.
These things were hits. They have thousands of plays.
The Pong, now I know you said the computer space was the first one with any kind of AI in it.
Yeah. The Pong doesn't. It's two-player only.
Two-player, yeah. You need two humans to bother with
it. You do. Or you can fiddle with the two knobs yourself.
Right.
Yeah. So
the hands of your brain can compete. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, because this thing literally was made 1 year after Computer Space, a lot of the logic, a lot of the approach that they employed with Computer Space carries over to this machine.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, there were no arcade monitors. They hacked the TV for composite video.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't make proprietary chips. It's all off-the-shelf parts. So I already knew, I'd already been through this whole rigmarole with Computer Space, so I was already pretty confident that whatever's going on with this machine, I can fix it. So I started by doing the same thing I did with Computer Space, which was recap it and connect it up to a composite TV.
Mm-hmm.
So I did that, and it was in way better shape than Computer Space in the sense that, like, it syncs up with TVs. You could put it on an LCD panel even. As long as it has composite video, it'll sync up to it. The sync signal for Computer Space is particular, so you need a specific TV. Pong doesn't care. If it's a normal TV that takes a 60 hertz interlaced display, mm-hmm. it'll take it.
Right.
So at the beginning, I already knew, like, it was...
Yeah, that 30 frames per second was already a standard.
Yes.
Long into the early days of TV, so...
Exactly.
Yeah.
So already I could visualize my game, and I could tell it had problems, but they weren't major. So it had like a perfectly working demo mode, which is when like it shows the scores and the ball just bounces around and there are no paddles. That's how the game is until you throw in a quarter. Once you throw in a quarter, the scores reset, the paddles show up, and mm-hmm. then it serves to one player or the other at random.
Okay.
Yeah. So I rigged up a button to simulate coin presses, and I pressed the button, nothing would happen, and I was like, shit, okay, so there's something wrong. So thankfully, Pong's schematics are better, but they're still not great.
Right. So they're not written on a napkin, at least they're on paper.
Exactly. So it's the
symbols are a little more consistent.
Yeah, there aren't random chunks of the circuit that do nothing like there are with Computer Space.
Right.
But it's still, you know, it's not, but it's a, you know, at least a better documented machine. And so I was able to figure out, you know, what part of the circuit runs the coin slot, what part of the circuit runs... And what I figured out is that there's this one chip that sends something called backslash attract, end attract, to multiple parts of the board. And so basically the game has two states. It has a track mode state and a game mode state.
All right.
And so
a track being like a marketing term.
Yeah. A track mode meaning like the ball bouncing around state,
right, like,
of the game.
Ooh, pretty, but what is that?
Let me investigate. Let me put in a quarter.
It's so weird thinking about being enticed by a pixel moving around the screen now. But yeah, I mean, at the time
it was.
What?
I mean, you have to think about, like, it's a frame of reference we don't have anymore. But like back then, televisions were something passive. It was something that, you know, you get broadcasts from ABC or NBC, and that's what they did.
Right.
Interacting with a television was an alien concept.
Yeah.
And so just the fact that a TV had a little ball bouncing around was like, what the hell?
Right. We're still coping with that. We still don't know how to deal with, you know, podcast.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, not really. It's kind of an individual stream to everybody's, you know, computer. And
absolutely.
Our language is still hamstrung,
right,
from that mentality. Still, after 40 years of video games.
Yes.
Is it 40 years of video
games? It's 50 years of video games, just about.
Oh my God, just, 50 years of video games.
Yeah.
We're still saying, you know, everything's cast. It's not a cast.
No, it's not.
It's not, yeah.
No. So, yeah, so...
And by the way, ask questions. If you have any... I can't believe you don't have questions. Ask questions, okay? And text me if you need to, or you can go on Facebook. Sorry, go ahead.
Not sure. All right, so I figured out, okay, it's not sending that and a track mode signal to all the chips to start the damn game. Mm-hmm. So using a logic probe, I was able to kind of work my way backwards from the coin slot to a specific chip which sends that end attract pulse, and it's supposed to go from a low state to a high state to start the game, and it mm-hmm. I'd throw in a quarter and it just never would, even though everything leading up to that point was working correctly. Mm-hmm. So, and thankfully, just like computer space, it's all off the shelf parts. I can just go to a, you know, Micro Center or whatever and buy the chip. So I just desoldered that chip, put in a modern one. That was it.
Came right up. Nice.
Yeah.
So it just burned out.
Yeah, it was just one chip. I mean, I was lucky. It was a very simple. I mean, finding it was hard, but the problem was simple.
So yeah. So one of the things that solid state meant back in the day is it technically was supposed to last forever. So
yeah.
So whenever you had those tech blueprints, it would actually have a little thing and it would just say like forever or something like that.
Yeah.
And it meant this is never supposed to burn out.
No, it's never supposed to burn out.
Right, yeah. But of course, you know, nobody, how the hell would you know that? Because transistors were like 6 years old.
Yeah, they were. Yeah, they were.
I know this through magic, you know.
Of course.
Theoretically, we're never supposed to burn out.
You know it burns out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, now we know that, yeah, so even chips eventually burn out. But
absolutely. But back then, like you said, it was new technology.
And so it was forever.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So
why do a schematic when you know the machine is the working schematic?
Right.
Yeah. The code is the documentation. I've heard that somewhere before. Yeah. Anyway.
But yeah, I mean, to its credit though, I mean, the damn thing's pretty robust. It's almost 50 years old and it's mostly fine.
Wow.
yeah. And yeah, go ahead.
So how did you get into? So you just got into electronics. So you have your neurology degree.
Yeah.
And you're just doing some science and you need to build tools for yourself.
Yeah.
And then that's how you got into soldering and learning.
Yeah.
Taught yourself electronics.
And part of it was,
or you just teach yourself.
It was straight up mentorship. So you know, my bosses at the time had to do the same kind of stuff. And so even if they didn't know how to do exactly what I needed to do, they knew how to solder. They knew how to build things. And so they could kind of point me in the right direction.
Give you 50% and let you do the rest.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's the thing about you know, a career in science that people don't necessarily know unless they've done it, is that it's totally like becoming a blacksmith or becoming an auto mechanic or something like that. It's a mentorship. There's someone who's an expert and they impart their knowledge to you, but then, you know, you're going to go out and do your own thing and become your own specialist in something unique.
So it's interesting. There's in the Linux space, so I'm like a Linux specialist and I've got a Linux, you know, pretty late compared to, like, you know, how early in video games this stuff is.
Right.
But, like, you know, still pretty early compared to most people. And I had, you know, a mentor who got me into it, and I found that most people do who were into Linux back then had someone who went, hey, you got to check this out, you know?
Yeah.
And it would show them, you know, some of the basic ropes, and then they go from there.
Right.
But, like, actually, I'm finding that may not be the case anymore. We may be entering an age where you don't actually need a mentor anymore, and I'm not saying that's good or bad. It just is. And it's mainly because of videos.
Because, yes, and that's absolutely the case for me. I mean, I did have a mentorship at the very beginning, but this is before I even started taking that know-how and applying it to video games. And so, you know, once I started fixing systems, it was incremental, you know. Like, my very first project was actually rather ambitious, and I think I kind of lucked out. And, you know, I have good hands, you know, because of neuroscience stuff and what have you. But
because of genes.
yeah. yeah, partly.
Yeah,
but then, you know, my subsequent projects were incremental. I would start with simpler systems and kind of work my way up. And a lot of my education absolutely came from videos. Part of it also came from joining other communities. Like there are retro repair communities that I'm a part of, people who know far more than I do and who are all about sharing what they know.
Right.
And even though they're not physically nearby, they can still, you know, do quite a lot and help quite a bit.
Yeah, so, you know, in the computer industry, you know, there's a ton of people out there, and particularly in the closed source program specialties, more than the open source.
Yeah.
But even in open source, there's people who are just information hoarders. You know, everything they know gives them an advantage, and they don't want to share.
Right.
And I'm sure you bump into this too.
Yeah, they exist.
And it's like, I they must be really smart because they definitely are at a disadvantage. You know, because when you share, then other people want to share with you.
Share with you, absolutely.
And you just, the sum is more than the parts.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I don't even know how they function, honestly.
I don't either. I mean, I've totally met people like that. And, It's just, I mean, thankfully they're a minority.
Don't be like that. You're at a disadvantage. Even if you, even if you are smart enough to pull it off without interacting with other people, yeah, you're definitely putting yourself at a disadvantage. There's always something more you could achieve.
Yeah, there is.
Yeah.
I mean, the few I find who do that, I find also tend to view this as a business, what I do as a business. And in principle, one could make a living doing this, but I think, A, it would be extremely difficult. And I don't want this to be my job. I love this. This is fun.
Well, so someone actually quoted to me. It's fictional, but it was a great, you know, great movie, great line. A quote from the Joker. You know, from Nolan's Joker from the second Batman movie, the Christopher Nolan movie.
Yeah.
And the Joker said, you know, if you're good at something, never do it for free. But I would like to point out that the Joker is a psychopath. So yeah, you know.
Yeah.
You know, he's the bad guy, guys. You know, this isn't. He's not Yoda, all right? Stop listening to him.
Right.
you know, there's going to be consequences, maybe undesirable ones.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway. So, so that's great. Where were you when you learned to solder and to do all this stuff? Were you at B&L? You worked at B&L?
No, I didn't. Columbia.
You said
yeah.
You said.
So I did some at Columbia, but even before that. So my background is I started my I did a master's at Villanova University in Philly. So I lived in the Philadelphia area for like a good couple of years, like 7 or so years. And so I started with a master's. I started actually in psychology at first, and then
that's right. You're pointing at the DSM-5 again.
Yeah.
So you totally know what he knew what this was immediately when I pulled it out.
Yeah.
It was like, oh, we're getting serious, huh? I didn't know. I didn't know if you would disagree. How dare you, sir? And I'm like, all right, I'm going to quote it to you and read it out. You know. Yeah, I usually try to avoid that kind of stuff. It's not fun.
No.
You know, if you get too serious, you can't explore concepts, and that's what I love doing here.
Absolutely, yeah. It makes sense to me. So I started in that, and then, you know, as a part of training in psychology, you get exposure to biological psychology or neuroscience, and I was like, no, this is way cooler.
Nice. Okay.
And so I switched over and I did a master's in behavioral neuroscience at Villanova, and then from there transitioned to a PhD at Temple, which is also in Philly. And so it was really during that time in Villanova and at Temple where I started learning about electronics. And by the time I was at Columbia, at that time I had a mentor who knew nothing about it, so I was teaching him. It was completely the other way around. I mean, he of course was teaching me other things, but that's just the nature of how it goes.
Well, I think there was this, I don't know the phrase, but I know that there is at least one martial art where the concept of the master is also a student.
Yes.
I think that's a universal thing in most martial arts, but I think Aikido. That's one of the key principles of it. Yeah,
yeah.
You're not just a master; you're a student. You're always a student.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's very much the way science is, for sure. Yeah, and certainly when you get further on in
science.
Your career.
What if people can go USA? I can go science.
Science. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know how much you know about open source or if you love it, but
I really see open source
as the reference model for science.
Yes.
Open source is the computer science reference model, and computer science, because of open source, is now the science reference model. Because it's almost the perfect meritocracy.
Yeah, it really is.
You really can't, you know, if you can contribute, your code succeeds, and if it doesn't, you know, a lot of people pay lip service to Darwin, but they don't really want to take it that seriously.
But it very much applies there, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I mean, and of course, I'm not saying we shouldn't be compassionate, and we shouldn't show compassion for people who maybe can't contribute at the top level
of
performance.
Course. No.
But, you know, that's not, meritocracy is about being able to contribute at the where you're needed most, as opposed to just assigning someone that role who maybe can't fulfill it,
right?
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
And just as a descriptor, it works. I mean, that's totally the nature of how these things work with regard to coding. And like you said,
with code, you know, it's basically free.
Yeah,
yeah, you know, like the Raspberry Pis are essentially free.
Right.
The barrier to entry is almost goose egg. It's so close that even in the poorest towns and the poorest countries. countries, you theoretically could afford a base level machine so you could enter into computer science and
right.
participate.
And it doesn't matter who you are or who I am. If you're the best computer expert in the world and I'm just some novice, if my code's better, it's better. It doesn't matter.
Right, right.
There's
yes.
no...
yes, absolutely. And there's a few kernel hackers who came up that way, who just wrote something and they're like, hey, what do you think about this? And they're like, that's better. How'd you do that?
Yeah.
Because, and in fairness to the academic environment, because,
yeah.
you know, you might be tempted to go, well, we don't need schools then. You know, more than half of the Linux kernel hacking community is PhD computer scientists.
Yeah, absolutely. It's
you
not
know,
like...
But there's also people who are nobodies.
Yes.
Yeah, you know, who are just brilliant.
Yeah.
And they just have the natural knack for it, and they're accepted as well.
Right.
Considered equals or peers.
Right. Yeah, I will have to say about my own training in electronics that there are drawbacks. So sometimes I'll be trying to diagnose a circuit, and I may figure out the mechanics of it, but the deeper knowledge of how it works or why it was done that way is lost on me because I don't have that engineering degree. I don't have that deeper knowledge of why it was done in a certain manner. I might pick it up
it's
later.
All about heat.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I know. That's a lot of things.
It's kind of a joke in the industry, right? Yeah, basically, it's everything in all electronics, all computer chips, everything. It's all just the air conditioning business.
Yeah.
It's all about limiting the amount of heat that you have to, limiting the damage the waste heat does.
Yeah.
Yeah, and dispelling heat. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I actually have heard that.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean.
And then it's dead fields, but mainly heat. Well, then the induction fields, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's you don't want things to interfere with each other.
With each other, yeah.
Right, and I don't have that's it. I just ran right off my knowledge cliff.
For engineering,
I know people who are EEs, and they could go much further on that. But
you know, it's funny though too. I've met EEs who have that deep knowledge, but they don't know how to do what I do.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that strange. Like, if you really understand how these circuits work, then how is it you can't take them apart, diagnose them, and rebuild them? Or
well, they could say that they were working on more interesting problems, trying to figure out how to cram the the 10 millionth circuit into a tiny chip. But
yeah, or maybe sometimes it's just that they're talking. Their knowledge is theoretical and less applied, and so they may just not have that hands-on.
I mean, I love hands-on. You know, I love taking something and using it in an unintended way. You know, that's one of the core philosophies of Unix, and it's affected me. It's affected my life.
Yeah.
Actually, I'm kind of like a bit of a maker. I like to invent stuff.
Yeah,
I mean, you know, just
same
like
here.
Little dumb things that I don't even want to say because it's just embarrassingly stupid, but they add up.
Right? Yeah.
You know, like I'll be like, I don't like this on my car. I don't like this in my house. I'll fix it. I'll make it out my house. I'll give an example. Like, I have a fireplace, and it just... I was like, you know, the fireplace, you run the fireplace and it's very inefficient. I'm like, let's make it more efficient. So I go out and I find a cast iron heating system, like a fireplace insert. But it's not really, my fireplace is especially small.
Yeah.
So I can't use a normal insert. So I'm actually had to use an oxyacetylene torch to cut it down to size so that you could use it and actually get it into the, and now I can heat my house with wood.
That's awesome.
Right? But like, it's just a dumb little thing. Like, I'm embarrassed to even brought
it up. No, but it's the process and it's the experience and
right.
Yeah, that I totally get that.
Yeah, everything is like, you know, got like rough cuts on it, you
mm-hmm.
know, in my life because
yeah.
I can make this better.
Yeah, but you know, if you had to do it again, you'd do it better. You'd find a way to engineer it better. And,
right,
and
I can make it work. I can't always make it pretty, but I can always make it work.
yeah, that's totally a lot of what I do too with the video game consoles. That's not just a matter of fixing them. It's sometimes about making them even better. Like a lot of the things I do are like modifications to improve the video, improve the audio.
Right.
Like take an NES and output HDMI or something like that.
So you are super polite. I can't believe you haven't said anything. You did express an interest in the alcoholic beverage, the adult
beverage.
Yeah,
we should drink.
Before. Yeah, let's drink.
Fair enough.
All right. So, I'll let you pour it. Why not?
All right.
So.
You want this one too?
Oh, yeah, good.
All right.
Great.
Excellent.
So.
I was just getting carried away, because, yeah.
No. Well, you know, it's funny. It's the same shtick I do every week, but it works every week, because it is, what time is it? It is, we've been doing this for 2 hours. Is that right? 2 hours?
2 hours.
It feels like half an hour.
I know, right? We have so many things we want to, you have to come back on the show.
Sure.
You're going to come back next week for the panel, right?
Yeah, I'll come back.
All right, great. All right, excellent.
What?
What's up? What's
tomorrow the fun? Tomorrow is the Area 51 raid.
Oh, wow.
Oh, wow. I didn't... Are they? Well, the owner of the idea, or the original owner anyway.
He went to make a concert and he bailed out last second, saying that he felt that it would become a fire festival.
Right, right.
So I've spoken to people who are there right now. They said basically.
Really? What our engineer is in touch with people on site. Continue.
Okay.
They basically said that there is essentially a handful of people there, rather than like a huge crowd of a million people,
right,
which is to be expected.
Excellent.
That's freaking awesome. But you know what? Those are the best people.
The meme died, and there's nothing there.
Or at least the most interested.
Yeah.
The meme's dead. Nothing's there. Nothing. So they're just kind of there for no reason.
For nothing. They're just in the Nevada desert.
They're not going to have a rave or any concert because that's not happening anymore.
Right, right.
All right. So just camping out in the desert.
They're just going to sit there, probably do some opioids, and get smashed. They'll see some aliens one way or another.
Well,
so.
It would be interesting though if the aliens were like, ah, fuck it, why not? And that's first contact.
Yeah, there
they're
we
like,
go.
Like, hey guys, what's up? It's real. Meanwhile, the Navy is telling us it is real, so what am I supposed to think? You know.
Yeah,
I guess
awesome.
I wonder, the timing on that is really strange, you know. I have to wonder about the Navy coming clean about there being UFOs, right? Because that again makes them look weak. The full spectrum dominance has been their
thing.
Their mode for decades.
Yeah.
You know, and for them to admit they don't have it anymore, is this the timing
odd.
With the Area 51 raid is suspect.
Yeah.
I mean, they must be like, okay, this is getting to be a problem for us. So maybe it served its purpose, even if no one showed up. Yeah. Cool. So this whole line of questioning. Cheers, by the way.
Yeah. Cheers.
Cheers. So the future of video games.
Absolutely.
And aliens.
And we might be in it. The question is, are we? There's two questions I could do. Actually, this is kind of the more interesting one. Are we in a simulation? You know?
Yeah.
Right, video games seem like inevitable in hindsight, right?
Yeah.
And, I mean, they're already photorealistic.
They are.
On the most modern machines with the most modern games.
Yeah.
You know, like, you really can't, I mean, when I played Drake, the latest version of Drake Uncharted,
mm-hmm.
I was just like, what?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
PS4?
That was a phenomenal game, and you're right, the realism in there was pretty...
It was disturbing. It was.
Yeah.
It actually affected my brain a little. Like, you know? And I have a PS4 VR system.
Oh, you do? Yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, I've done VR, so it wasn't the VR aspect, it's just when it's so realistic, it affects you're thinking about it.
I know exactly what you mean, yeah.
Right, right. I mean, you're really immersed in it, and so, like... I mean, we're just dealing with the technologies of neurology and interfacing with the brain without any latency or lag.
Yeah, and just tricking the brain into thinking that it's real.
Is that happening? Or,
yeah,
know?
It's absolutely going to happen.
So we're in a simulation already.
Yeah, maybe we are.
We might be, right? How would we tell?
Yeah.
Right? I mean, you know, if you have a day full of synchronicities, you're like, really? You know, a lot of people, well, there's a lot of... It's like kind of like this social, like almost movement or reaction to sequential synchronicities. You know,
mm-hmm.
like the reaction that most people have is my phone is spying on me.
Yeah.
But everyone's had one of those days, one of those my phone is spying on me days.
Sure.
You know.
Absolutely.
And
yeah.
Maybe it wasn't spying on you. Maybe it's just really a large series of coincidences that are extremely unlikely.
Yeah, and our brains are engineered so that we don't buy into tons of coincidences. We buy into that's something.
Right, right. That's
yeah.
a pattern. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a product of our evolution. It's yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I really think that's what do you think that that's what makes humans special, or that we're capable of doing that kind of pattern recognition?
Yeah, it's our ability to be self-reflective, to have consciousness, the fact that we have this neural network that's so massive and so complex that it can have self-awareness, and that we probably, at least on this planet, are unique in that respect.
So, sorry, go ahead, Steve.
I didn't say anything.
Oh, okay, sorry. I thought he said something.
Yeah.
Whoa, weird, man. Synchronicity. it's kind of like, you know, it's almost like the AI question, you know, legit artificial intelligence. Everything we've seen so far isn't really AI. We call it AI, but it really isn't. It's mostly machine learning.
It's mostly machine learning.
Just throwing piles of code at piles of examples and coming up with something that no one understands and can't do anything else.
Right.
It almost seems like the neural interface and the artificial intelligence question are very similar.
They are similar. And It's also equally hard to define in a human being, even though we all, at least most of us, agree that we have consciousness and awareness. We can't operationally define consciousness.
Speak for yourself, sir. I am pre-programmed for success. Never mind. I can't go anywhere good with that. So it's an interesting problem. So where do you think the key to AI is? I mean, you must have wanted to work in this.
Yeah.
It seems like the perfect crossover for your background and what you're actually doing for fun.
Yeah, it's a good
side.
It's a good crossover. Yeah. Sorry, state the question again.
Have you been doing any work in AI, and are you considering it?
I've considered it, but I've never done it. But yeah, I think you're right that my experience with neuroscience could lend itself well to that, because
You could definitely understand the gamer.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. I mean, the interactor, you know, the victim, whatever.
Yeah.
Depends on what mode it's in, you know, whether it hits the singularity or not.
Right. When you talk about
singularity, is when artificial intelligence is smarter than the smartest person on earth,
yeah,
and just starts to run away from us.
Right.
You know, runaway is a familiar topic in electronics. So.
it is.
Yeah, yeah.
I think the there are definitely a lot of parallels between what I do as a neuroscientist, like in the sense that, like, I'm thinking about, you know, brain pathways in terms of circuits. I'm thinking about circuits in terms of circuits. But there are some interesting differences, which I can kind of talk about.
Sure, sure.
So, you know, when I'm talking about the behavior of a machine, whether it's machine learning or AI or what have you, it's all pure electrical. You know, it's all electrical. And when I'm talking about you or me or any organism, it's not just electrical, it's chemical.
Right.
It's a mixture of the two.
People are extremely are chemistry baths.
Yeah.
Sometimes literally, we're just
very much
the chemical that affects how we think is present in our entire bloodstream.
Yeah, like a hormone, for example, is that. But even if you're talking about two neurons talking to each other, so when a neuron, and I don't know if I need to go this basic, but I might as well. So
yeah,
you know,
let's assume.
Yeah, sure. When one neuron needs to talk to another, it starts as an electrical signal and it propagates down the cell, and then it gets to this little kind of like, it's like, imagine like an octopus, like a little tentacle, and there's a little button at the end that has these little pods that can release chemicals called neurotransmitters, and the neighboring cell will have receptors that pick up those chemicals, and those chemicals can either excite it or inhibit it or modulate its activity in some kind of way, and that's how cells talk to each other. Mm-hmm. And then of course internally there's tons of chemical processes that cascade and lead to this kind of communication. And so the thing that's different about chemistry versus something electrical is that there's a big part of it that's purely random, that has nothing to do with whether it's deliberate, like, or coincidental. So, you know, like, molecules are not intelligent. They don't have a purpose. Mm-hmm. They go where they go. And biological systems get around this problem by flooding the zone with chemicals. So if one neuron wants to talk to another, it's not a simple matter of sending one chemical over.
It doesn't send one molecule from one cell to the next.
No, it floods the zone. It just bathes the other guy in a ton of transmitter to communicate. But mistakes happen all the time. Stuff happens where genes get activated unintentionally, lead to cascades, lead to firing between one cell and another, completely unintended. And so biological systems have tons of redundancy and tons of checks to deal with these kinds of accidental things, these mishaps, mm-hmm. so that they don't override our behavior. And occasionally, though, they do override our behavior. So that's a difference between an organic system and a synthetic system, is that, like, synthetic system is purely electrical. It's gonna discrete logic systems follow the rules that they're designed to do.
Right, right.
An organic system follows rules.
If you're above this voltage, it's one. If you're below this voltage, it's zero.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, but and organic systems work like that too, but there's a bit of randomness mixed in, and maybe that's the critical difference that separates what we do. And
that's pretty much my success story, right? Just do some random stuff. Quietly back away from the stuff that failed so no one can see that it was me, and then try another thing.
There you go.
And then when something succeeds, be like, see, I am a genius. and then continue on the path of randomness. No, I'm just kidding. Some stuff was more deliberate. So actually, some stuff in my life has been more deliberate, and I've seen that plenty of times, too, where people mm-hmm. very deliberate. So I think, and please, you can feel free to chime in. So I mentioned I have a novel scientific theory offline.
Yeah.
I call it civ gene or the civilization gene. Mm-hmm. And the idea is that one of the last evolutionary steps into what we think of as modern civilization is that was the birth of the conscience. Mm. And of course, this is not. And actually, what it is it's psychopathy is the absence of the civilization gene.
Right.
So I mean, because so have you found anything? I don't know if you. How much you studied psychopaths or looked into them when you
were... To some extent, yeah, little bit.
So you understand that, like, you know, effectively the rule of thumb is if they have a conscience, you're not a psychopath.
Right, that's just a defining part of having that condition, you don't.
Right, you don't. So, yeah. So I see a lot of the attributes of, the social attributes of psychopaths and how they react with their environment in the animal kingdom, right? We project a lot of stuff on animals that's not really there.
Yeah.
You know, like, my favorite example of this is, you know, every once in a while someone will get wind of my civ gene stuff and they'll be like, oh, you know, clearly animals have a conscience because blah blah blah, and 9 times out of 10 it's because a human is interacting with both animals mm-hmm. and has somehow inadvertently trained one of them to do the thing that they're doing with the other animal.
Yeah, it's a hard thing to find because A, it's a human defined construct for one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course.
B.
Well, specifically, I think that what the conscience is a risk engine. Mm-hmm. And I think what it is our subconscious, our imagination, or our conscience, that thing that grinds away at night and makes our dreams, is really a database that a back-end relational database that forms a risk engine. Mm-hmm. So in other words, it's emotional metadata. And what happens is the emotions that you could probably tell me which chemicals this was that did this in the brain, but that essentially our emotions are stored with our memories.
Yeah.
And we can reference our memories in two ways. One is which is through the common neural pathways that we talk about a lot, and the other one is through by grouping them by emotion.
Yeah, emotion actually
is... And
that's
how we're able to pick up risk like this, and that's what makes our conscience a risk engine and makes us different than other animals.
Yeah.
Also, I mean, there's lots of other things that make us different. We're pink and hairless and... You know,
yeah, sure.
You know, walk upright. You know, we argue with each other and lie a lot. You know, but this, you know, this is also one of the things. This was one of the last things that we did.
Yeah, I think it's one of the things that really distinguishes us from other organisms. And you can find things that are somewhat like conscience, or you could operationally define as conscience in other organisms. But it's going to be a short list because there's a lot of preconditions. I mean,
right. So usually, what people do is they hit me back with, they go, oh, okay, you know, well, what about bees, or what about ants, or what about naked mole rats? And of course, the answer is they're family.
Yeah, no.
Most of and there are extended tribe structures with monkeys and such. But of course, anyway, I'm not trying to prove this. This is this would be ridiculous for me to try to prove this to you.
No,
I think the conscience is a risk engine, and I think I just wanted to put that out there, and, you know, if you ever want to take a look at my stuff and tell me I'm wrong, I'd welcome it.
Sure, I'll take a look at it.
Yeah.
I mean, you're not wrong about the fact that tying emotions to memory makes memories far more potent, more significant, more powerful. That's absolutely the case. That's my
part. Do you know the Hare MRI tests? You know, the ones I'm talking about? So the Hare did this experiment where he would have a person read a list of words, and some of the words would be like just like, you know, bedroom mm-hmm. or carpet or cloud, or and then one would be fuck. and when they read that word, most people their brains light up like Christmas trees.
Yeah.
And I saw that and I said, oh, that's a wild card search. And the reason I said that is because when psychopaths read it, their brains don't light up like Christmas trees.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
Yep.
Makes sense.
Yeah, so, I mean, I don't know. I'm hopeful that this is a... And this is one of the reasons... And this led me down this... This is where this MIT thing came from with Richard Solomon. So you're probably like, where the fuck did that come from?
It was interesting.
Yeah. I mean, it's a new take, right?
Yeah.
So this is why I kind of went down this winding road, and eventually I got to the point where I realized, oh, psychopaths don't want us to murder them in a witch hunt.
No, they don't.
Yeah. And that well, yeah, sure, they don't have a conscience. They're not always useless. In fact, sometimes they're extremely good at something.
Yes, they can be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So maybe if we stop trying to kill them, maybe they'll work with us and be more willing to come out and say, hey, I'm a psychopath.
Right.
Right. So the only person I know that's done that who's really far along in that white-collar world is James Fallon, who also happens to be a neuroscientist.
Hmm.
And diagnosed himself when he saw his own MRI and said, oh, that's a psychopath, and then
realized.
Took his thumb off and realized it was him.
Yeah.
Took his thumb off the name and realized it was him.
Right.
And he's very underreported, but, you know. Anyway, I just thought I'd throw that all out there. So
yeah.
The tie-in for artificial intelligence is the Microsoft, I don't think I put it in my long-term list. There was a name for it. Microsoft had an artificial intelligence that they put out on the net.
Okay.
And then people started interacting with it and became a horrible bigot within a few days. And when I saw that, I went, oh, it doesn't have a conscience, of course. That's
right.
What a psychopath would do.
Right.
You know, that's what I saw. No one else, you know, but I think that's actually what...
It's called Zoe. No,
Tay,
I'm sorry.
Tay, yes, right.
Tay.
Because there was a singer that was going to sue them because that's her nickname.
Oh, that's kind of funny, too.
Right. That's Taylor Swift, right.
Oh, my God.
Because it was this horrible bigot, and it had the same nickname as Taylor Swift. And there was the rumor that she was threatening to sue Microsoft.
Oh, my God. That's brilliant.
Yeah. I mean, you can't make this stuff
that's
up.
That's wonderful.
The technocracy, folks. You're living in it.
Wow.
So when I saw that, I'm like... Oh, it doesn't have a conscience. That's why it happened. Yes, please.
You got it.
All right. So, I think that that's what's really missing in the artificial intelligence world. Not that I'm trying to encourage people to build Skynet.
No.
That reminds me. So this all ties back. Sounds crazy, right?
Uh-huh.
I'm like the
you need a chalkboard.
I'm like Booger with in that famous meme picture.
Uh-huh.
With all the strings going between the articles.
Exactly.
But it ties back to aliens and the UFOs and idea that if there is intelligent life out there and faster than light travel is possible, that there's a pretty good shot that they're here already.
Mm-hmm.
You know, same concept when, you know, computers were fast enough to support, now, please, if this is wrong, this is the perfect time to hear it.
Sure.
That computers are really fast enough for the first time to support human-level computational power, like the human mind-level computational power,
yeah,
in about 2014 or so. So
okay.
You could argue it was 2005, you could argue it was 2020, but somewhere in there, based on Moore's Law, we were going to hit the same level of
computational power as a human.
As a computer, right? So theoretically, if you had like a compute cluster, which I'm sure you're familiar with, right?
Yeah.
Right, anytime you get any kind of embarrassingly parallel computational problem,
right,
you want to put it to a cluster because it happens faster.
Right.
And you get the result faster.
Yes.
And that there's a 50-50 shot that AI wasn't really that hard to code. It just needed a fast enough computer.
Hmm.
And that someone inadvertently created a singularity, and it's already loose.
Okay.
Yeah, right? Because how would we know? We wouldn't be smart enough to spot it. I mean, we might get lucky.
Yeah.
But it might make a mistake, and we'd get lucky.
And we'd get lucky, but...
Yeah, I mean, if it was smarter than us, theoretically, it could be hiding on the internet already, you know, in a million...
But it's kind
of
like...
You know, Trojan miners.
Right.
Breaking into people's, cryptocurrency miners, and we'd never know
but
it's actually a singularity.
But in some way, it's like an unfalsifiable thing. You can't.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah.
It's terrible science.
Yeah.
You know, but it's interesting.
It is interesting. It's not that it could be wrong either. It's possible.
It is possible.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Science doesn't disprove the stuff at the periphery. It just ignores it.
Right.
Yeah. Most people don't get that. They're like, but science. But no, science just ignores that. It doesn't care about that.
It's not within its domain. It can't
right.
be. It doesn't fit within the rule set of science.
Right. Because when you get into that mentality, you get into where you stop looking at the periphery, and you don't learn anything new when you stare at the mean. You have to look at the periphery if you
right.
want. Because sometimes it's error, but once in a while, something new.
Yes.
Yeah. I love the periphery. Thank you. I want to hug the periphery. Anyway, so... Anyway, any thoughts on that whole mess, that hot mess I just threw
in
your lap?
Man, that's going to be tough to unpack.
I could have done that in a more organized way, but
yeah.
It just seemed like I wanted to tie it into our conversation.
Yeah, I'm thinking about it. Yeah, I mean, do I think we're there yet? Probably not. And again, I think it's because of the nature of the way organic systems operate and how I feel like they're just fundamentally... That one key piece, the randomness, is not something that you get in a synthetic system right now. Maybe through the way you code you can make things random,
but... Well, they have quantum computers, but they're not that far along.
Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, yeah. Quantum computers, which are not binary-based, they're multiple-answer-based, they're field-based, or, you know, range-based.
Yeah, and maybe that's what could get you there, because right. That more accurately mirrors up with what biological systems do.
Yeah, I honestly don't really understand quantum computers well enough to say whether they could or they couldn't. Mm-hmm. It does seem like that would be the logical fit, and that's the logical path that a lot of people are going down.
Yeah.
What you just described, so.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not really itching for AI anyway.
No, I mean...
It seems like most problems could be solved with, you know, sufficient machine learning.
Totally.
And I mean, if anything, you would think that, you know, psychopaths would be unhappy about, you know, at least the whatever tiny contingent of people that are decision makers that are psychopaths,
yeah,
would be extremely unhappy about the prospect of artificial intelligence coming
right.
along, and because they wouldn't want the competition.
No, yeah, and it would be superior competition most likely, and
yeah,
then
yeah, or at least it would be the path to superiority would be clear,
yes.
and unencumbered.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. This is, and in a lot of ways, you know, this is. We don't have to answer these questions. This is one of the reasons that I like this. You know, a lot of people are very focused on answering questions and, oh, you know, there has to be a definitive answer. When you have an open mind and open-ended and ask open-ended questions, that's how you make progress.
Yeah, exactly.
And everyone wants to make progress, so.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. It's if you know all the answers, then you're not learning anything. If you're just going through and...
Right, right. It's just busy work. It's toil.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, you know, the whole computer, the Linux industry and the computer industry in general is just obsessed with getting rid of toil. And I mean, that's why we're going to get... So that actually reminds me, just completely off this topic, but...
Yeah.
What do you think about the labor glut? Do you think that there's a risk of... Is there going to be an automation wave? Is it going to accelerate? Or...
Do
you think that there's... personally, I think that the solutions is shortening the work week, like we've done before. You know,
yeah.
We're not working in textile factories 80 hours a week.
Yeah.
You know, so maybe just cut it down to 30 hours a week or 25 hours a week is appropriate to the labor glut. We've done it already, so there's precedent.
Sure.
But also, some people are saying, no, what we actually have to do is we have to grab money out of the system, be it a taxation scheme and return it to people so that they can use that money to buy themselves time. I'm not necessarily against that.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe the whole thing's not real and it's just going to be like everything else and, you know, more jobs will be created and, you know, we're tilting at windmills. So,
yeah.
You think we're tilting at windmills? And if not, what's the solution?
I think that particular cycle has repeated a couple of times.
Yes, it has.
It has.
Yeah.
And
which would tend to indicate it could happen again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like at the start of the Industrial Revolution, the same kind of thing happened. Lots of automation, people thinking...
People were running from the farms to the factories, even though the conditions were terrible.
Yeah. 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 And so the question is, what kinds of new careers and new job pathways will open up? And maybe that'll... I mean, I think it's too early to know now, but I definitely think more automation is certainly coming. More types of jobs will disappear, but will it mean that there's a big glut of people? I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. Cool. You're sufficiently educated. You know, there aren't answers to every question. Well,
no.
Some people don't know that. Some people think they have to answer every question, and that's perfect.
Of course. Yeah.
Any input into, you know, having done neurology stuff before?
Yeah.
Any input into potty mouth and cursing and what effect it has on people? Or
I think
have you found that people who have potty mouths are, you know, more intelligent or have, you know, a different kind of insight into the world than other people?
Yeah, that's interesting. I think people who obsess over it and think it's like a big problem. I don't get it. I curse. I have no problem with it.
Right. Well, obviously. I mean, of course, you know, I think some of that is children, right? You know, people are afraid their children are going to be exposed to something too much too soon.
Yeah, but...
Which is definitely the case. You have to control your environment for your children.
You have to control your environment for your children, but it's also good to appreciate nuance and that context matters a lot when you... You know, there's an entirely different thing when I'm saying fuck yeah because I just fixed computer space versus
you earned that fuck yeah. All right. Yes.
versus, you know, like using that word in a different kind of context where I'm insulting someone.
Right.
And being able to appreciate nuance like that is absolutely critical if you are a smarter person, if you're intellectually curious, if you're trying to develop yourself that way. And so I find that a lot of people who I would consider intelligent and they approach cursing in that kind of way. People who moralize about it and focus on and obsess about it, I don't tend to find.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Well, language is shifting faster every year now too. So
yeah, that's true. Also,
you know, I mean, this is one of the, actually this is one of the things I put in the list. Actually, I don't know if I didn't circle this one. I had this concept of the complexity horizon, mm-hmm. where literally concepts are moving faster than the words we have to describe them.
Yeah.
Which is kind of like what was happening with those in the early days of those games, right? Because the
Absolutely.
Documentation was garbage.
Yes.
And one of the reasons the documentation was garbage is because nobody had done any of this stuff before, so the concepts didn't even have words.
No, they didn't. No,
you know,
no.
I mean, like, if you're the first game with AI, you know, for your alien UFOs that you're fighting, there's no word for it.
No, there isn't.
Yeah.
No, so, no, and we.
It's not like you can write AI on a chip and you know which one was controlling the UFOs.
Yes, we've been through that at different stages of technological innovation, and absolutely during this period of time, people didn't know how to talk about or what they were experiencing. People didn't know how to use the controls. People were just actually, there's an interesting anecdote of Ted Dabney and Nolan Bushnell setting up the very first computer space in a bar. And just like, you know, trying to get some impressions of what people think about it. And
doing market research.
Yeah, just doing very unscientific, very preliminary market research and seeing. And people playing the game and not quite getting that their button presses led to changes in the television. And actually looking around the back of the machine looking for... Yeah, looking for an antenna. Like they were trying to find a broadcast. They
right,
didn't
right.
they didn't get that they were in control, that they
Peter
could do stuff.
In the back of this cabinet.
Yeah. And you also even
I might do the same thing.
Yeah. Right? Yeah, they didn't have a way to their worldview was need to get shifted.
So that's even next level above what I'm talking about. Like, you know, like in this. So one of the things that happens with complexity rising, of course, which is that you can express yourself in code, or in that case, you can express yourself in circuits, right?
Yeah.
You can just say, this is what I'm talking about, and solder together a circuit and demonstrate what you're
talking about. Yeah.
Right, right. But this is now that code is essentially free. It's very cheap to do that.
Yes, it is. Yeah, yeah. Easier than ever before.
But it's like this concept of I don't know if you've ever heard of cargo cult. I'm sure you
Yes, I have.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
So, and I mean, apparently, like, the Polynesians, when the you know, the U.S. Navy sailed into the port on some of these islands that had never been visited by modern
anything,
people,
yeah.
modern anything, and they literally didn't know what they were looking at.
They thought they were looking at gods.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it may as well have been a Star Destroyer or, you know, a giant Cthulhu, you know.
Right, so they had to frame what they saw in the context of what they knew.
Right.
And it took them years or maybe, I'm not even sure to what extent that still exists.
Literally were building wooden airplanes, and they would have their shaman come and bless it, thinking that it would fly off the top of the mountain.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
Like not, no engine or anything, just a facade of an airplane.
Of an airplane.
Yeah, yeah. It'd be yeah. like if I said, look, I built a computer space too, and I just presented you with a banana, you know. Right.
Exactly.
Right,
exactly.
Right.
I mean, it doesn't even just extend to just common average Joes who are playing the game. It even extended to the creators of the game itself.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the way they... When you read the service manual for something like Computer Space, the way they talked about it was just odd in terms of the way that we normally think of things. Like, the logic boards, they were talking about it. They called it the brain box, in quotations. That's what they called...
Yeah. That's so 70s.
I know.
Don't spill anything on the brain box. Don't make the brain box angry.
Yeah, they had these sprinkled throughout the service manual are these odd expressions that just don't have correlate.
Is this service manual published or?
Yeah, it's open, it's available on like archive.org.
That's
you
great.
Can peruse it.
That.
You can read it. And there's just all sorts of oddities like this that
I think I'm gonna pick an oddity to start using it all the time. That's really the brain box. Maybe brain box. That's really great. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. It's just, it's funny.
Right. We need a brain box on the show. yeah, cool. So, you know, I mean, so it's kind of an interesting on the one hand, you have the kind of that complexity horizon, where people are just they're just technology is advancing faster than people can come up with
can
words for it.
Catch up with it, yeah.
Right, but on the other hand, you also have people who are like, who was it? I forget who it was. I put it in here. Was it? Oh no, I didn't put it in here. Yes, I did. Yes. No, I didn't. Yes, I did. Jack Dorsey from Twitter. That was.
Oh,
it.
Yeah, sure. The
well,
founder
he was,
of Twitter.
He wasn't the originator of this, but he's the one who's saying it in a modern context.
Okay.
Fairly recently, like within the past 10 years, he said code is law.
Hmm.
Right? You know? But if code is the only way you can express an idea, but code is also law, you know?
Yeah.
If it's both, you know, then essentially being able to understand an idea that you can't express and expressing it means you're the lawmaker, right?
Right, well, you're your own which lawmaker, is, which
yeah.
doesn't...
And hence the Technocrat Live is born, you know, as my satirical and sometimes amusing critique of modern society. You know, I needed a word for it, so now
right.
it's Technocrat Live, right?
There you go.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah, crazy, right? I'm kind of curious, what are you into pop culture-wise? What kind of shows are you into? Do you have favorite movies?
Yeah, so...
Everybody's got one.
Man, that's a tough one for me. I honestly don't watch television anymore.
Really?
I really don't. And it's not because I don't...
Netflix, YouTube, something.
I watch a ton of YouTube, but it's all didactic stuff. It's all about...
It's all how-to.
It's all about teaching myself more stuff. It's all about just finding new projects, finding new ideas.
Two-thirds of mine is didactic stuff.
It's just me consuming new ideas and implementing them. And so I'm a big fan of others who are more talented than I am and who do all sorts of stuff like that and share their work.
Hey,
and
there's no Renaissance man. We can't do it all.
No. That's something you always need to learn when you're doing stuff like I do, is that as good as you are, there's always somebody better than you, and you should always, you know, appreciate that and learn from them and try to make yourself better.
Or just challenge them and insult them and try to get them to fight you. And then no, I'm just kidding. Don't do that, please. That's a joke.
So
the wine, people. It's the wine talking.
That's right.
The wine's making me wine.
But yeah. So I mean, yeah. Go ahead.
No. I mean, this is not like, how about old sci-fi? Were there books?
Yeah. So old sci-fi. I mean, I read a ton of that as a kid. I mean, I was.
Who's your favorite author?
Oh man, I mean, it's not sci-fi. I mean, I read a lot of Carl Sagan when I was a kid.
Nice.
A ton of Carl Sagan. I mean, I'm a fan of all the huge things like Star Wars and stuff.
Well, I have. So some people are like that. Some people in the tech industry. I consume a lot of sci-fi. I consume a lot of pop culture.
Yeah.
But also at the same time, you know, I kind of have an artistic streak too, where, you know, it's more like kind of interpretation and whatnot.
Yeah.
But I have friends who just read manuals. They don't know fiction.
No fiction at all.
No fiction at all. Everything's nonfiction.
Yeah.
You know, and in particular, technical nonfiction.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's not weird.
No.
Yeah, maybe it's weird if you're not in part of the technocracy, but it's definitely not. it's not strange. How about what do you think about game reward structure?
Yeah, that's very interesting stuff.
What do you think is good, bad, and what's your favorite?
Yeah, coming, I'm going to go back to neuroscience for a little bit, because one of the things that was a real focus of my training and my education was, well, one was the neurobiology of learning and memory, and the second thing was addiction. So I was really interested in, and my whole dissertation and a lot of my work was focused on context-dependent learning and how that can play a role in addiction, and basically trying to understand the neural substrates of addiction. And so people...
I have to fact-check something, so keep going.
Yeah, sure. So a lot of stuff that goes on in gaming can be understood in that language of addiction, where basically you're, you know, trying to get the player to continue to do something over and over again, like microtransactions, like, you know, you get some kind of bonus, you get some kind of reward, something mm-hmm. like this that continues play, that continues activity.
What does that do to the brain?
Well, that's an interesting question too.
we can come back to it. If
you No. I'm gonna no. That was kind of where I was segueing to anyway. So interestingly enough, drugs of abuse and a whole slew of things that we find enjoyable or pleasurable, and that can include video games, that can include things like certainly drugs of abuse, sex, you name it, a whole bunch of stuff that we find pleasing activates this part of the brain called the nucleus accumbens. And so that part of the brain is critical for anything pleasing or rewarding, and it can be argued that, I mean, drugs of abuse certainly hijack that reward circuitry and make it dysfunctional. But it could be argued that other things in life...
What circuitry do you think it's hijacking?
Well, drugs of abuse hijack all sorts of circuitry. Reward is a big part, but it's not the only thing. Mm-hmm. But things that are arguably addictive, like video games or like food or sex or something like that, also can have similar effects.
Sorry. Just bringing the rest of everyone else in. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
Do I think one can get addicted to those things? Possibly. I mean, that's a bit of a philosophical question as much as it is a scientific question. Is there a neurological overlap? Absolutely. There is no doubt that there is a neurological overlap.
For sure there's official, I'm sure I could find it in here,
Yeah.
This is just for reference, this is like the psychology handbook. If something's official, it's in here.
Right.
This is the kind of thing that schools or courts use to define whether somebody's insane or whether somebody's
has a mental illness of any kind.
Has a mental illness or had an appropriate reaction to things. It's considered they do this specifically so that everybody can have a debate and be kind of on the same page. Because the brain is so complex and behavior is so complex, it's really hard to do that.
Yeah, to try to create a unified standard for everything.
Right. So at least everyone's using the same language and they're not all over the place.
Exactly.
Psychopath doesn't mean 20 different things.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah. So I continue.
Yeah. Sure. So video games can totally fall into that category. But
we're talking a lot about loot boxes. And the effect that they have on the brain and particularly kids. Not understanding the odds. Sinking real time and or real money. Time is money to some degree, but,
Right.
Labor is what gives money value to some degree, but, just sinking real resources into just taking random chances.
Yeah.
Or toiling in a video game to get currency economy.
Yeah. What all of that brings to my mind is things like variable interval or variable ratio schedules of reinforcement in rats and mice, where where you take a rat or a mouse and you put them in a box and you train them first something simple, which is press a lever, you get food, and make sure that they're hungry so they're motivated to eat and search for stuff. And then you make things harder where you make it so that a random amount of time has to elapse before you get food, or some low probability of lever presses, before you get food. And when you put them in an environment like that, they press like mad until they get their food. And this is even more dramatic if you're using something addictive like drugs, where if you get a rat hooked to cocaine, you can make them press thousands and thousands of times in order to get just a single hit of their cocaine. Mm-hmm. Or if you set them up in an operant environment and you have to ask them to choose between two things, like cocaine versus sex with an available female, or like a whopping pile of food or something like that, they'll always choose the cocaine and they'll always press like mad for it. Mm-hmm. So do I think video games can fall in that spectrum? Maybe, but it's certainly at the lower end of the spectrum. Can you certainly construe some of the behavior in video games in that way? Absolutely. And so things like loot crates and things like microtransactions work in the same way, where people don't understand probability. It's a hard concept for our brains to wrap around.
It's hard for science people.
Yes, it is. It's also, scientists frequently make mistakes with probability. It's just
Isaac Newton's South Sea Bubble. Look it up. Yeah.
Yeah, video games can be designed in such a way that you just get them to keep pressing. And hell, this is not even new. I mean, if you go back in time to the 70s and 80s, people wonder why, Nintendo games, earlier video games were really hard. The reason why they were really hard is because they were direct ports off of arcades, and arcades were designed in such a way that you would die after a few minutes so that you could put in another quarter.
Right.
Yeah, it's a different kind of behavior, but...
The quarter was the lever,
yeah. Exactly. And the way that you got the kid or the adult to keep pressing, to keep putting it in, was to make the game hard. Yeah. And this is just a different way of doing the exact same thing. So now we're not putting quarters in a machine, but we got to keep getting paid, so you create microtransactions where you get a little boost, a little bonus, or you get a loot crate where you have some low probability of success, and you keep paying. And so it's not necessarily new. It's just a new mechanism of doing the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's been with us since video games have been with us. And yes, do I think it's addictive? Sure. But do I think it's on the same scale as something like heroin or cocaine? Absolutely not.
So scale. So even if some of the attributes are in common,
yeah,
the scale matters.
The scale matters. And even if the neural correlates are similar, it's not the same.
Neural correlates?
Meaning like the brain areas that are hijacked by it.
Right, okay, yeah.
That's what I'm saying, sorry.
Yeah, no, it's fine.
Yeah.
You know, it's my ignorance is perfect for them, right? So I just ask, you know, like, sometimes I'll give you a ringer question and I actually know the answer, and this time I don't know.
Okay.
Sorry. No, it's fine, it's funny. Hey, you know, every it's a cargo cult for everybody at some point, right?
Exactly, it is.
Yeah, if you had a god with a mind the size of a planet, you know, we'd all look pretty stupid.
Yes, we would.
Yeah. I forget the name of the guy, but I saw a really great thing, and it actually really struck me, and I even wrote an article on it, a blog post on it.
Yeah.
And this idea that the opposite of addiction is connection. Have you heard that? What do you think about it?
The opposite of addiction is connection.
Because it seems like connection uses at least some of the same neural pathways and create some of the same chemical reactions in the brain.
So what do you mean by, explain what you mean more about connection?
Well, that connection with other people, specifically.
Ah.
You know, like that really, if you know, like, I hate to use an animal, but it kind of makes it easier to give it a control. You know, dogs get a dopamine hit when they stare into humans' eyes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, and we do the same thing.
Right.
Yeah, we do the same thing.
So, like, is maybe the possibility that part of the problem that the children are having? I mean, of course, this is obviously always a good idea. So I'm kind of like taking a cheap way out.
Yeah.
Taking a safe example, but you know, holding your child and saying I love you and looking into their eyes, you know, for 1 minute out of their video game day, you know, might create a situation where they're no longer addicted. You know?
Yeah, it may. I mean, I feel like...
If they were ever addicted in the first place.
If they're ever addicted in the first place, yeah. I think the people who really go off the deep end need that kind of social connection and don't have it, and this might be their only source of anything pleasing in their life, and if that's the case, then that's certainly going to exacerbate the problem.
For sure, some people who are addicted to drugs are self-medicating.
Yeah.
They're dealing with something they don't know how to deal with. You know,
yeah.
That's an attribute, actually, a lot of psychopaths. A lot of them are addicted to drugs and alcohol because they're self-medicating. They know how to cope with society. We're all a bunch of crazy Muppets. You know, they're cold and rational compared to us. They're like, why do I have to live in this world of madness where everyone's a cartoon?
Absolutely. And taking some of my other examples of food or sex, people absolutely do the same thing with those things. Like, I feel like shit. I'm going to eat a pile of food.
Right. Comfort food.
Yeah.
Bonbon time, baby.
Yeah. So anything...
Watch a movie and eat bonbons.
Anything that has that kind of addictive property can fall into that category, I would think.
So you hadn't heard about the connection versus addiction?
No, I hadn't heard that, but it totally makes sense. I understand it. It's
definitely plausible, but you don't know.
No, exactly. That's what I would say.
Okay, yeah, it seems very plausible to me too. I'm hopeful that it turns out to be true because then the solution is pretty simple.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So. Let's see. So, of course, addictive algorithms is one of the things that we were talking about. So, what do you make of the current state of science, and particularly funding for research and how research is done and how people do peer review on each other's work?
Yeah, that's a great topic because I could talk about that forever since I was, you know, in academia for a while.
Right.
So the state of funding is rather abysmal, I think. So, I mean, that is the main reason why I left the lab. I absolutely loved working in the lab and, you know, coming up with ideas and testing them and getting things published.
Doing pure science.
And doing pure science. And if I could get funded in a reliable way or if I could have some kind of guarantees there, I would drop what I'm doing and jump into that in a heartbeat.
Mm-hmm.
Because I love that work. The problem is that, yeah, NIH is absolutely underfunded.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't matter what question you're talking about. And you know, like the way that it is, funding is so tight that you know, all sorts of questions that could potentially be interesting are ignored, and it's only things with direct clinical relevance that might get a lion's share of money or something like that. And
political?
There's some politics to it, but it's not politics in the sense of with Congress or something like that. It's politics in the sense of that people who've had a big impact on the field can have a disproportionate effect on who gets funded and who doesn't. And who you know matters.
Which could be good, right? Like, so theoretically, you know, like if someone who's really accomplished and discovered something amazing thinks this is where we should be looking.
Yes, and there's some,
and that would be
there
a good
is
thing.
Some goodness to that, some utility to that. But then there is some kind of exclusion to that too, because if I have a good idea and I'm a nobody, that's a strike against me. My idea might get funded, but I'm going to have to do some pretty Herculean convincing to get it noticed. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah.
So that's a problem. I mean, so
or just get lucky and stumble across something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Some ancillary thing to what you were actually trying to accomplish.
Right. Exactly. Some of the stuff that is
like a good example. You know, in case we're being too abstract, a good example would be like Tesla. Ah, I want to learn about electricity. Oh, by the way, this could be used as a super weapon, which would be unstoppable, and no one else would be able to stand up against us. Go on.
Tell me more. Yeah.
Yeah. But not a lot of science isn't like that. It isn't applicable. It's just that it's a stepping stone where maybe something like that would happen 5 steps in the future.
Right.
So it's hard to get money and interest.
Yeah, that's a problem. Like there are a lot of more basic science. Is a harder thing to get funded too, because there is no necessarily direct application for it, and and like you just said a moment ago, you know, a lot of the huge discoveries come from basic science, and then only later on it's like holy shit, this is huge.
Just one in a decade at least.
Yeah, or like something like optogenetics. I don't know if you know what that is.
No, please go.
Yeah, so optogenetics is this fantastic tool in neuroscience where. People identified these interesting receptors in jellyfish that activate or inhibit cells based on a wavelength of light. So
I heard something about this.
Yeah. So basically, there are these channels that are naturally expressed in jellyfish, and if you shine a light on these channels, they open up, they'll activate cells, or they'll inhibit cells, or they'll modulate cells. It has to do with the way that jellyfish communicate and how they deal with light. And so this sounds esoteric and boring and whatever, and people wouldn't fund it. But eventually, people figured out how to take these constructs.
If you didn't think that sounded boring from his subscription so far, you should be subscribing. This is for you, because I didn't think that sounded boring at all. I was like,
yeah, well,
I got it.
Yeah,
<Keep going. laughs>
well, I mean, as you might guess, like, no one gave a shit about this, and people didn't fund it at all.
Right.
At some point, not too long ago, I can't remember exactly when, let's just say like 10 years ago, maybe a little more, some people figured out that you could take these constructs, you could transfect them, you could put them into mammalian cells, and not only that, you could selectively target them so that they're expressed in the cell type that you want.
Mm-hmm.
And so that means you could selectively activate or inhibit cells in a neural circuit.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is way better than the techniques that came before. Before this, you'd have to use drugs where you could, you know, you just bathe a whole bunch of cells with an excitatory...
The typical chemistry. So one of the things that's hopeful and that maybe we'll be seeing in the future, in the near future, is kind of a nanotech approach where you start placing atoms and molecules. Because normally in the past, up until now, essentially, we've just been pouring atoms. You just flood the whole body with a chemical and hope the side effects aren't too bad.
Pretty much, yeah. And that's what you do. You just send out a whole bunch of drug and you try to activate cells. And it could be any type of cell. With this, you selectively activate just the cells that have this with light. And the other cells don't have it, so they're not affected at all.
Mm-hmm.
So as a simple example of what you could do with this, you could take this construct, like channel rhodopsin, you could put it into a rat in motor cortex.
Mm-hmm.
And by shining a light through a window up in its skull, you could make the mouse move.
Now you understand.
Yeah, so that's the part of it.
Yeah.
But the cool part of it is that you
scurry, can... Scurry, little rat, scurry.
Yeah, so the cool part of it is that you can really understand how circuits work this way. Instead of just, like, hitting it with a hammer, you can hit it with a surgical precision strike and get a feel for how a circuit works.
Right, yeah. And also, you know, just you know, want that particular field once I'm sure people understood it a little better.
Now the money pours in.
Yeah, this chemical, there's definitely commercial applications.
Absolutely. This is a big thing now in neuroscience. There's tons of money flowing
military
towards that.
For camouflage, fashion, you know, any kind of, you know, you can create, you can tap into the circuitry at a neurological level by simply adding the gene and to test whatever theory.
Even understanding how diseases work, there's like a ton of applications that use optogenetics. It's a really nice tool. And before this, it wasn't getting any funding. It was just a nice, you know, it was a serendipity moment that took this thing from being very underfunded to like massively overfunded. Mm-hmm. And so that's the problem with the way that the current system is. And I think if there was more money in the pot overall, then some of these basic science questions could be better scrutinized. And yeah, plenty of them will lead to nothing, but then there's going to be a subset of them that revolutionize the field, and you wouldn't find them otherwise.
Right. So one of the things that I have, one of the things I think is underrepresented or underfunded or underfocused in the science world,
yeah,
and this is not necessarily true in computer science, but it's true in is peer review. You know, people make discoveries, they publish results, the results look plausible, but
yeah,
nobody ever tries the experiment again, in particular when the experiment is hideously expensive.
Yeah.
Yeah, and to me, I think that maybe we need to, just as a society, we need to, you know, just a little bit of social pressure. We don't need to always go to laws. We can always just say, hey, we need to do this,
mm-hmm,
you know, and say, hey, we really should be so X amount of percentage of dollars to go back through scientific journals and actually try some of this crap.
Yeah, replication is a big problem because only a subset of people end up having their stuff replicated. And sometimes you just get a one-off thing, and that's totally happened to me, too, where you find some kind of interesting result, but it's an outlier.
You mean an outlier at the periphery?
Yes.
I love you outliers.
It's happened to me. I've had experiments that I've designed and found something interesting, and then for other reasons had to replicate it because I needed to do that component for another part of a paper, a publication, and I never got it working again. And at some point I just realized, like, I'm not doing it wrong. That was just a fluke.
Right. It was an error.
It was an error.
It was dirt. It was a particle from space, you know, and
yeah,
just, you know, hit my thing at the wrong moment. Yeah,
right.
Whatever.
Who the hell knows?
God.
But it was whatever. Just some kind of freak event.
Lava, psychic powers.
Right.
You know, whatever. Yeah.
Whatever.
So you think I already did it?
Yeah. So.
Iron filings.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So, yeah, replication is a part of science, and it does happen, but not nearly enough. And having people dedicated to that would be good, or having a system in place for that would be good. I mean, there are other things that peer review gets right, though. I mean, I've seen it both ways. I've seen peer review get it wrong.
No, of course, I'm not.
And the part that I think...
Science!
Yeah.
You know, right.
The part I've seen get right is when you have somebody who reads your work, and they see what you're getting at, and they propose their own ideas, which really flesh out your own, mm-hmm, test your own, and make your overall presentation, your overall publication, healthier and stronger. That's happened to me more than once. I mean, at this point, I don't have any. I'm never going to publish again,
really?
Probably. Yeah, yeah,
that's
yeah.
Great.
Oh, yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, I have, I think, 16 or 17 publications out, and some of them.
Wow, you're pretty accomplished.
Yeah, I've gotten.
I mean, I've seen
bad.
People like ready to kill each other just to get their name on the bottom of one.
Of one of them.
Of one of them. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm fortunate. I mean, I worked with great people. I got a bunch of things out, and on not all of them, but on many of them, I was fortunate enough to have a good peer review process where people looked at my work and said, you know, this is awesome, but did you think about this or did you think about that? And we were able to go back and test out those proposed ideas, and it ended up just making it even better than it was beforehand.
Right. So one of the solutions to my proposed problem, you know, whether it's real or not, I think it's real, but, you know, which is in line, right? Your peer review happens while you're preparing the initial paper in the first place.
Yeah.
So that you're having multiple tests, you know, which of course is, you know, I'm not picking on companies. I'm not saying they don't add the science.
But
sometimes they like, oh my God, if we rerun this experiment and it fails, we're out of business.
Right.
I mean, it just happened. One of the which pharmaceutical just went out of business?
The
it was
one
the one
Purdue?
That made OxyContin.
Purdue.
Purdue. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. They just died.
So, yeah. You know, this is what happens when if you get if your star product gets peer reviewed and dies,
yeah.
You're done.
You're screwed.
And I mean, I don't even I'm not even happy about that. I mean, even if a lot of some people hate OxyContin, but I mean, this is terrible. You know, they were doing science and they could have discovered something really great. They could have discovered the cure for cancer tomorrow.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, absolutely.
And yeah. So, I mean, I like the free market, but at the same time, yeah, it's going to be a lot of disruption before we get to reap the benefits of,
yeah.
You know, a bad management structure
yeah.
being replaced.
Hell, I even know an anecdote. Well, I can't go into all the details, but I can give you enough of an anecdote to with industry. I know a whole group of people that...
It's a great thing about having multiple jobs. You can't really be sure what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I mean, some of these people I work with, and I there's, like, disclosure, so I can't talk about...
Yeah, no, of course.
Yeah.
Don't get lawyered.
I know a team of people who worked at a pharmaceutical company, a big one. They successfully got a drug to market that works, that's good, that's effective, that everybody... that's usable. And shortly thereafter, the entire team got laid off, and they got laid off for success because they became too expensive to pay for, and the higher ups decided, like, you know, let's have a neuro team, but let's just, you know, start from scratch instead of paying these guys more money.
Right.
And it's like, you know, these people innovated, they
this
succeeded.
Is bonkers, by the way. Completely bonkers. This happens all the time in IT too.
Yeah. So I mean, that's not
Park. The original, the guys who came up with the first GUI.
Yes.
Speaking of first computer systems.
Right.
Yeah. They completely dissolved. You know?
Yeah.
But those are the guys that wrote. Those are the guys that came up with a mouse. If you're doing this right now, you know, with a mouse,
it's from
the guys who did that got laid off because, you know, there was no revenue path forward.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's insane.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, the other problem I have with academia is the lack of opportunities for advancement. So if you stay in that realm, there's a glut of talented, hardworking, outstanding people and not nearly enough positions to support them. So mm-hmm. when you look at universities and you look at faculty openings and all that kind of stuff, there's just a small fraction of faculty openings and thousands and thousands and thousands of postdocs. And those are people who work hard.
They get treated like garbage, man.
Yes, they do. They work
postdocs
hard.
Postdocs get treated like garbage, and I'm not trying to discourage you from going into science, because not saying this is don't go into science. I'm saying this sucks and we need to fix it.
No, yeah. Go into science because you can do a lot of things apart from academia, which is precisely what I did.
Right.
But and what most of them do. But postdocs work their asses off. They're smart. They're innovative. They're the ones behind all the work, behind all the papers.
Right.
And some of them, they're just waiting and waiting and waiting for their own faculty position. And I have friends. I got my PhD in 2010,
mm-hmm.
and they're still postdocs. And that's sad as hell. They're 9 years in, and they're still postdocs.
Mm-hmm.
They're still making less than a manager of a Starbucks or a McDonald's.
Right.
They're doing groundbreaking, innovative work, mm-hmm. and that's bullshit.
It is bullshit.
They should have a fucking faculty position. Sorry.
No. I feel really bad for them. And they, you know, and actually, the usually the IT departments of these universities and these institutions are so desperate to hire IT people.
Mm-hmm.
Half the time they end up going into IT for just to keep their lab to progress their science, and they end up switching careers and going into IT, which isn't a bad thing.
Yeah.
But you know, that's one of the things that happens. But like, yeah, I mean, I'd be standing in line next to a postdoc, and I'd be having a 4-course meal, and they'd have a bagel.
I know.
You know, and I'm like, this is fucked up.
I know, it really is.
I really feel bad for them.
I know. I mean, I, in my current job, visit labs all the time. I deal with postdocs all the time, and I can't tell you how many of them ask me for career advice and say, how do I get out of this situation? And it's sad, because they
usually go corporate, seems to be what they do.
Well, yeah. Most, yeah. Like a good like 60-70% of them do.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said to you before, if the circumstances were different, you better believe I'd be back in the lab. I love being in the lab. But I don't want to live like in the subsistence level and do hard work and work, you know, 90 hours a week
for
nothing.
It'll affect your health. I mean, you know, we most people don't realize we get cancer all the time. Your immune system kills it, right?
Yeah.
And if you're under extreme levels of stress, your immune system's suppressed. Guess what? You're getting cancer, buddy.
Totally.
You know?
Yeah, that's how it works.
Yeah.
Lots of people, and I've known people who were in their teens who got cancer who were under tremendous amounts of stress. You know, and that's what does it.
Yeah.
I mean, your body has a system to deal with this. You can't push yourself too far. Steve's like, Steve was showing us this calendar before, and George is just like, damn.
Yeah.
That's why Steve's making noises back there. Yeah, well, you know what? I mean, also, at the same time, of course, you're healthiest when you're youngest, so the time to do it is when you're young.
Sure.
You know, when you get to be my age, you know, you're like, ah, screw it, whatever. It'll just happen or it won't. You know? Right.
Yeah.
Well, this is, oh, God, what's his name? How can I forget his name? Watson.
Oh, yeah.
James Watson. Said that, you know, most people make their major discoveries in their mid-30s.
Yeah.
It's not because people later than their mid-30s aren't intelligent. It's because you hit a point where your body starts giving you externalities physically.
Yes.
If you stress yourself out too much.
That impede you from working yourself at that level you need to.
You can't sleep 4 hours a day. You have to, you know. And actually, it's funny. I talked to James Fallon. I've met him. I actually talked to him. And he said that's one of the advantages that psychopaths have over non-psychopaths is they don't really have to sleep that much.
Yeah.
So, you know, literally, that's what you have to do to compete.
Yeah.
You have to not sleep.
Not sleep.
Yeah.
And I totally...
that's not good for anyone. That's
no.
Really not, it's not good for them. Plus, it's not good for science.
Yeah.
Yeah. I really would like to, you know, like, see more funding put into... to science, not only to reviewing existing, go through the journals, just write grants, you know, to go through and look at old journal entries, you know, and if a company starts getting really squeamish because you're going to redo one of their experiments, that means you really need to redo it.
Yeah, that's all the more reason to do it.
Not to be mean, but you know, that's the way it is.
Yeah,
I'm upset about Purdue, but at the same time. You know, was it Purdue?
Yeah, it's Purdue Pharmaceuticals. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm really sad about Purdue, but at the same time, you know, that's going to have to happen sometimes.
It does.
For science.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's self-corrective, and the more you fight it, it's going to get corrected eventually.
So we're almost out of time. I want to ask you if we could go a few ways. Would you rather go more personal or more science questions?
I could go either way. I'm cool.
Is there something you want to ask me or something you want to add to the show that you haven't had a chance to just speak freely about?
Let me think about that. nothing's coming to mind right now, but I wasn't expecting that.
No, it's fine. I want to make sure that I tell everyone before the show, this is their show. You know, you guys see me every week. Oh my God, don't talk anymore, Matt. Shut up. You know, people are like, stop interrupting him. Come on already. You know, obviously because I have another question. Maybe it's a little bit of ego too. Who knows? Hopefully not. But you know, I mean, that's. You know, like I don't want to block you from
now that I've had a little time to think, I think one thing I'll go on about a little bit is the fact that, like, you know, going back to the video game stuff and the retro repair and restoration and stuff like that,
mm-hmm.
I definitely try to encourage people to not be afraid to dip your toe in the water and try it out for yourself and see what you can do. And don't feel like this is just the realm of someone who's like an expert or that this is like something inaccessible or something like that because it isn't.
Nice.
It really isn't.
Yes.
I mean, I didn't know...
That's like the message of the show, man.
I mean,
really, it is. You're like, don't be discouraged. Don't
yes.
let people dissuade you from participating.
Right.
Even if all you do is this, you did this.
You did it.
No one else did that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right. I don't want to be the only guy on Long Island fixing everybody's stuff. I don't. I don't.
You don't scale, huh?
No. There's too much out there, and it's important work. If you're passionate about electronics, if you're passionate about computer history, video game history, this stuff isn't going to last forever. The longer it can be kept going, the longer future generations can see it. I can't fix all of it, and I don't want to be the only person fixing all of it. I want to teach as many people as I can how to do this stuff, and I want people to also, who don't know me, to not be afraid and to go out there, experiment, and try. I mean, that doesn't mean like just blindly trying crap, because that's not what I do. I follow a method. I study, I research, I use my scientific process to do what I do,
mm-hmm.
but by all means, you know, don't be afraid. Ask questions. Read up on things. If you've got some old video game system or old retro computer from your childhood that's not working, it can work again. It's entirely possible. I mean, nothing's impossible. And so, yeah, that's probably one of the things I would say to the audience.
Yeah, that's a great thing. You know, I got into an argument with one of my friends. Was young, it was really funny. I was telling him, like, I'm like, I can figure out how to punch the world in half if I wanted to. And he was like, that's ridiculous. And I didn't even know about this at the time, but, you know, so I'm going to stand on the shoulder of giants. Forget what I said. That's dumb. Archimedes is like, yeah, just give me a place to stand. I'll move the world. Right? You know, he just needs a big enough lever and a place to stand.
Stand and he'll move the world.
Right, yeah. Exactly. So, you know, yeah, it's true. You really can move the world.
You can, like,
I mean, don't do it for no reason, you know. Right. Try to have a reason. Don't just move it because then the motions will be sloshing around and days will be different and everyone will have to change their clock. And I mean, I guess it'll make a lot of work in the IT industry, but
it certainly would, but yeah.
Don't do it for no reason, but yeah, move the world. Go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah, you don't know what you're capable of. I mean, like, if I had talked to my past self 10 years ago when I was doing some electronics, but just bare bones and nothing related to video games, and I would have been like, you're going to fix this thing, computer space. I've been like, fuck no, that would never happen. I don't know how to do this shit. And right. And here I am. I did it, you know?
Well, you know, maybe part of it is the fact that you freed yourself up because you went to work in corporate science.
Yeah.
And then you actually have more time and you can
Did. Okay. I couldn't have done this when I was in the lab because I was in the lab. I was doing like 12-hour work days, working weekends.
Right.
And intellectual bandwidth was there.
You warmed me up a lot to the idea of people moving to corporate science because I used to always be sad and be like, damn it, every time I knew a scientist who I knew was good and was doing good work and doing good science, he left and went to typically a pharmaceutical in my labs.
Right.
You know, and I was just like, oh, come on, really? You know, and I'm like, no, I'm like, yeah, maybe it's not so bad.
It's not.
You can still do science.
You can still do science. You do lose something, but you gain more than you lose.
Right.
That's
right.
How I feel about it,
well,
you know?
Thank you so much for being on my show.
Yeah,
everybody,
absolutely.
George Portugal, thank you so much. And
yeah, it's a pleasure.
We'll see you next week, right? You said you're going to be on the panel. Are you sure that's okay?
I'm fine with it. Yeah,
if you can, come on in. We're going to have a panel next week. It's going to be lots of fun. See you then.
Yeah,
good night, everybody.
Good
thanks
night.
For joining us.